Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Pray! This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
The names of the dead read out at last night's vigil in Quebec City, where thousands gathered to mourn the six men killed as they prayed at their mosque. People gathered in a show of emotion and support across the country yesterday. And the accused, 27-year-old Alexandra Bissonnette, a Laval University student with a history of far-right postings online, stands charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder, 5 counts of attempted murder. But so many questions linger. Why such a tragedy? Why here? Why now? And inevitably, the question of whether what has happened in Quebec is connected somehow to the larger story of chaos and fear enveloping people around the globe following U.S. President Donald Trump's actions banning entry to those from several predominantly Muslim countries. Paya McAvan has been giving all of this a lot of thought, and he joins me now to help try to make sense of the past few days' events. He is a professor of international law at McGill University. He's a former UN war crimes prosecutor at The Hague, and Paya McAvan is in our Montreal studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna Maria.
What were your initial thoughts when you learned that people had been shot at that mosque in Quebec City?
Well, Anna Maria, it's said that the Holocaust did not begin in the gas chambers. It began with words. And we've now had for some time this poison of populist hatred spreading in the political space in Europe and now in North America. And I think it would be naive to imagine that the normalization and mainstreaming of anti-Islamic hatred and scapegoatism wouldn't eventually spill over into violence. There are always going to be isolated instances of violence. There are people who are mentally unstable. There are people who are extremists. But when political figures, let alone the President of the United States, makes it acceptable to hate people merely on the grounds of their identity, we should not be surprised that this will encourage elements that otherwise would be at the margins of society to come forward. And I think it's tempting to see this as an isolated incident, but it's best to see it as the symptom of a wider disease that is spreading in our midst.
You draw a very clear line between the words that are spoken and the actions that are taken.
Well, I spent about a decade of my life working with the United Nations in the former Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, in conflict zones around the world. And one thing I've realized is that civilization is very fragile, that we can only put so much faith in our democratic institutions to keep the peace. And ultimately, it's our culture, it's our communities, it's our sense of empathy and engagement that prevents a small minority of extremists from whipping up hysteria. It is said that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And it's very disturbing to see what is happening, for example, in Europe with the UKIP in Britain, with the possible election of Marine Le Pen as the next president of France. We have to take very seriously what is happening in the West. And what I find extraordinary as someone who fled Iran, my country of origin, because of religious persecution, are the similarities, the profound similarities between Islamic extremism and now this sort of white supremacist Christian nationalism.
How so?
Well, for one thing, scapegoatism, creation of scapegoats. Jean-Paul Sartre famously said about anti-Semitism that, you know, the Jew exists in the mind of the anti-Semite. If he didn't exist, the anti-Semite would invent him. So we have to understand that this sort of hate and its expression through violence is about the needs of the perpetrator to find a scapegoat for his own misery, for his own misfortune. And we need to bear in mind that it's not just that we have hatred, but it's also that the liberal elites have failed. The liberal elites have failed to connect with the masses, and there is popular anger. We have an economy which has, through globalization, technological innovation, enriched the few at the expense of the many. One out of three children in the United States live under the poverty line. So the ordinary suffering and anger of people is something which, if it is left unaddressed by political, intellectual, and other liberal elites, is going to be tapped into by populist demagogues. So I think that this isn't just a case of condemning hatred on the part of extremists, but also understanding how the liberal establishment has failed to connect with the real woes of ordinary people.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
New at 10 o'clock now, backlash over some controversial photos. They show Cypress Ranch High School seniors giving a Nazi salute. Our Jennifer Bauer live now with reaction from that school district. Jen?
Yeah, the principal sent a letter home to parents yesterday. That's when the photos were taken, and that's when the photos started circulating on social media. These are photos sent to us by a student at Cypress Ranch High School. Notice the group with their arms in the air. In an email to Channel 2, the student tells us some classmates started shouting, Heil Hitler and Heil Trump. It was at least 70 or so people, and it was pretty terrifying. These were taken on Tuesday. It was picture day for the senior class. One photo was supposed to be serious. The second was supposed to be funny. But no one is laughing about this. The email goes on to say most people may think it was just kids just joking around. But in the current political climate and the fact these kids are seniors in high school, it's beyond unacceptable. In a letter home to parents, the principal said, while our senior class was taking a large group panoramic picture, several of our students made the poor choice of displaying inappropriate gestures. We are currently conducting an investigation, and those implicated will be punished according to the Student Code of Conduct. Now, in that letter that was sent home to parents, the principal went on to say that this is extremely disappointing because it's not an accurate representation of the student body here at the high school. We're live in Cypress tonight. I'm Jennifer Bauer, KPRC, Channel 2 News.
She's my friends, but I'm in France. I'm just saying.
With all the news here at home, it's harder to keep up with news from around the globe. I mean, remember the migrant crisis in Europe? Yeah, it's still happening. In France, for example, more migrants arrive in Paris every day. That's in part because last year French authorities dismantled a major migrant camp in Calais, where many migrants settled, hoping to somehow cross the channel to Britain. Now there's a new humanitarian center in northern Paris, but as Adeline Seal reports, already it's bursting at the seams.
On a cold, rainy day, Nassar Ahmad is standing in front of the gates of the new humanitarian migrant center. He's from Pakistan. He arrived here a couple weeks ago after crossing through a long line of countries. And now he has no place to sleep.
Camp closed.
Closed.
Yes.
So you can't sleep there tonight?
I am sleeping this road.
Under the overpass over there?
Yeah, this road.
The temporary shelter and processing center houses 400 people and will soon take in more, but not everyone who needs it can get in. Down the road, a group of men huddles over a warm subway grate on a muddy highway median. They're using blankets to shield themselves from the pouring rain. They seem to be in good spirits, though.
The weather is too cool out. That's why we stay here.
26-year-old Abdallah Khalil is from Darfur in Sudan, like many of the men here. Khalil left home in 2014 because of the war there, and after a long trek through Libya and Italy, he made it to Paris last month. He tried sleeping outside the gates of the migrant center to secure a bed, but they didn't have space.
I waited there 2 days and then I came here. I never enter inside.
When I ask how he can bear sleeping outdoors in this cold, he says it's no big deal compared to the terrifying 3-day boat trip he took across the Mediterranean. He wanted to go to England, but he's given up on the idea. Like many others here, he'll request asylum in France.
Now we are staying here and we want to live here to continue our education.
After France dismantled the Calais jungle in October, migrants like Khalil began heading to Paris instead. As many as 50 to 80 a day, according to Paris officials. In fact, last month, the French NGO Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, decided to bring a mobile clinic. But even they have trouble keeping up with the demand, and that leaves volunteers to fill the gap. In the Pajol neighborhood, about 24 homeless migrants stand around a picnic table set with hot tea dispensers and bread, hard-boiled eggs and bananas. Retiree Laurent Pichelin is part of a group of neighbors that organizes these meals. Here, there could be 40, 50, or even 100 people a day, Pichelin says. Some come later in the day because they live in remote hotels where they get no food. Pichelin laments that many of the men here don't have winter coats or warm shoes. One 16-year-old boy from Eritrea is wearing only a light hoodie and sneakers in sub-freezing temperatures. But the donations that used to flow into Calais are now arriving in Paris.
Jumpers, trousers and jackets. Jackets being the most important thing, literally everyone's asking.
British volunteer Heather Young worked in migrant camps around Europe, and she recently started her own group, Paris Refugee Ground Support. In their warehouse, she and other volunteers sort through blankets, yoga mats, shoes and clothes that they distribute at night in a van.
So we need at least 2 boxes of each size.
Yeah.
Young says she has to walk a fine line here. One rainy night, she tried to hand out blankets and even plastic bags to men sleeping outside the migrant center, but the police told her to stop. She says authorities don't want migrants on the streets getting too comfortable.
They're not allowed to sleep in a building. They're not allowed to sleep in a tent. They're not allowed to sleep in a sleeping bag. So we run around giving them aid, and the police tell them they have to move without their stuff.
Every day? Every day the police come?
Every day, more than once a day.
MSF accuses the police of harassing migrants. The group reported that police used tear gas to disperse men sleeping on the streets and took away their blankets. Police officials aren't commenting now, but Interior Minister Bruno Le Roux vehemently defended the police on a radio talk show.
Mais faut arrêter ce sport national de mise en cause des policiers. We need to stop this national sport of questioning the actions of the police. They have no orders other than to help provide shelter and safety for vulnerable people.
As for Abdallah Khalil, the man from Darfur, he is no longer sleeping on a subway grate. He finally managed to get inside the center and requested asylum. He might get it, though the odds are against him. In 2015, fewer than one in three asylum requests were granted. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
For a cop, as good as I, a book of guy for drinking crocodile. Don't resist a pit and pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
We've seen a lot of big protests over the past year, from Black Lives Matter to the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And since the inauguration, we've seen even more massive protests against President Trump's policies. Now, as Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports, a number of Republican-controlled state houses are considering increased penalties for protesters who block roadways.
Soon after Donald Trump was elected president, more than 100 protesters blocked traffic on Iowa's busy Interstate 80, just outside of Iowa City. It stopped traffic for almost a half hour. Now, a Republican state senator here wants to make it a felony for anyone who intentionally blocks traffic on busy highways, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Senator Jake Chapman introduced the bill. He's also the chief operating officer of an ambulance service.
You're not just stopping traffic, okay? You're impeding law enforcement's ability to get to calls where there could be serious life-threatening situations.
Opponents of the bill say there are already laws on the books. And there are. Senator Joe Bolcom is a Democrat from Iowa City. He says the proposal is punitive, unnecessary, and more about politics.
Republicans have taken over state legislatures across the country, and they appear interested in punishing people with different views than theirs that want to assemble and use their rights as free speech.
As Bolcom mentions, similar bills are cropping up in other states. Take North Dakota, where protests have gone on for months over construction of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline.
I believe that we will win!
I believe that we will win!
I believe that we will win!
A lawmaker in that state has a bill that would allow motorists to run over and kill any protester obstructing a highway, as long as the driver did not do it intentionally. There are bills in Michigan and Washington State. Last week in Minnesota, a House committee approved legislation that would increase penalties and charge demonstrators the cost of policing protests. Black Lives Matter protests blocked busy interstates last year in the Twin Cities following the fatal shooting of Philando Castile. Republican Nick Zerwas says the cost of these protests go back to the taxpayers.
These individuals have broken the law. It is against state statute to be on the freeway.
The hearing became heated when John Thompson testified. He was a friend of Philando Castile's, a black man who was killed by a police officer during a traffic stop last year. Thompson told lawmakers he did not block the interstate, but he understood the protesters' message.
You know what they were doing? They were asking for all you guys to come out and say, what is it that we can do to help you? Not one of you came out.
After the vote, a protest and chants of shame broke out in the hearing room, forcing the meeting to end. With protests likely to continue nationwide, Rita Bettis with the ACLU of Iowa says elected officials should be protecting free speech rights. She says bills like the one in her state do the opposite.
In our country, where the government's power flows from the people, peaceful protest is a source of democratic strength, not a weakness, and it deserves to be protected and cherished, not attacked.
Advocates like Bettis say if a few states can reduce a demonstrator's ability to block traffic, it could have a chilling effect on Americans' right to protest. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
Well, the law was in the South at that time that a white man cannot rape a black woman, period. That was the unwritten law. That was the common law all over the South. Black women, I mean, that came in, I mean, with their clothes torn and all like that, and said some white woman, some white man raped them, rather. They run out of there. Yeah, you don't arrest a white man for raping a black woman because they, you know, it was just understood. White men don't rape black women. Black women are loose.
An ex-cop appeals his sexual assault conviction.
Daniel Holtzclaw is doing 263 years for sex crimes against women while he patrolled Oklahoma City.
And tonight, News 9's Lisa Monahan tells us he and his attorneys claim, among many things, insufficient evidence. Lisa?
Yeah, Daniel Holtzclaw's attorney raised that issue and several others with nearly 100 pages filed today, claiming he didn't receive a fair trial during the highly publicized case.
He simply had too many cards stacked against him that never should have been allowed in a court of law.
In the appeal, attorneys for Daniel Holtzclaw claimed the state had insufficient evidence, lumped too many crimes together, allowed a circus atmosphere. Also, prosecutors argued facts not in evidence. He had ineffective counsel, and the sentence is unconstitutionally excessive.
Finally, the Holtzclaw family can point to something in black and white and say, this isn't just the family speaking. These are some very learned opinions from professionals that say that there were some things done that were extremely wrong.
Brian Bates began as the private investigator for the defense, and later the Holtzclaw family asked him to speak on their behalf, now in response to the appeal.
It covers just about everything that they were concerned with.
Namely, the issue of a circus atmosphere. Holtzclaw's attorneys claim publicity turned up dramatically during the 2015 trial due to the growing Black Lives Matter movement, with individuals taking pictures in the courtroom, protesting in the hallways, and even a victim testifying while admittedly high on drugs. The appeal also scrutinizes a key piece of evidence in the case, DNA.
Now we're finding out that DNA evidence very well may have been misrepresented. Some DNA evidence may not have been disclosed, and the prosecution's own DNA expert may have given testimony that was totally contrary to her own findings.
But Oklahoma County District Attorney David Prater responded, I am confident the conviction is constitutionally and statutorily sound. Furthermore, I am confident of this convicted rapist's guilt.
Now, I also reached out to the attorney representing the victims in the Holtzclaw case, but did not hear back in time for this report. Lisa Monahan, News 9.
The real Eddie Africa. For most people, if you mention the words MOVE organization, it elicits profoundly negative connotations driven principally by negative coverage by the corporate media. In fact, most people have never met a MOVE person, and whatever opinion they possess is based on media projections, not real knowledge. Today, you'll hear a MOVE member, Eddie Africa, a survivor of the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978, when police attacked the MOVE house at 33rd and Powelton, West Philadelphia. Eddie was one of nine MOVE members arrested there and sentenced to an unjust 30 to 100-year sentence in connection with the death of a cop who was part of the invasion force that attacked the house. For over the last decade, Eddie has counseled young prisoners, both formally and informally, in how to avoid the trap of prison, especially children in prison.
Oh, that's good, because this is one of the points I was trying to make. Children his age are just starting to step out on their own or think for themselves. But a lot of them are doing it without any kind of advice or guidance from their father, because their father's in here. Too many of them, their fathers are in here.
Eddie looks at some of the young prisoners who adopt bad ideas.
And a lot of these guys, when they come in here, they put the idea of their children to the side. And they tell themselves, I'm gonna wait till I get out. But we're trying to stop that.
Eddie is a warm, funny, compassionate man who at nearly 70 years of age is a magnet for young men who need guidance along the right path. Eddie explains to young fathers how to be with their kids.
Use this time to be with them, you know, talking to them, writing them. Hopefully it will help and teach some of these young guys so they don't go the path that their parents went. I'll be watching the news, and my last four or five cell partners were all young people who were in gangs. So I'm getting plenty of opportunity to speak with them and hopefully to discourage them from that so that they'll think about doing something a little more positive than being in a gang or running around and acting crazy. But it's just a matter of you give them respect, and then you can demand it. You know what I mean? A lot of the older guys, they don't want to talk to the younger guys. And that's a mistake.
For 38 years, Eddie Africa has been in prison. And such time could have made him a bitter, nasty man. In this, it has failed. He has been a resource to help young men center themselves on their families, on their children, on the future, not the past. That's the real Eddie Africa of the MOVE organization. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on.
Most often, the stories of major historical events are told from the points of view of their leaders, but PBS's groundbreaking 14-part documentary series, Eyes on the Prize, focused instead on ordinary people who risked their lives as part of the civil rights movement. John Els, who was the cinematographer and a co-producer of the series, recounts its remarkable story in a new book called True South, published by Viking. I'm very pleased it has brought John Els to our show. Hello.
It's great to be here.
It's the series' 30th anniversary. When you made it during the Reagan era, did you feel that some of the progress that had been made was slipping away?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think of that now, today. We were working during the Reagan era. President Reagan had announced his candidacy for presidency, in Neshoba County, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers had been killed in the summer of 64. He affirmed his...
Which some people took as kind of a coded signal.
You bet. And then he affirmed his interest in states' rights at that point also. We were also doing Eyes on the Prize at a time when public television and public broadcasting in general were under assault. The Republican Congress was trying to zero out, was one of their many attempts to zero out public broadcasting. But, you know, Henry Hampton, who was the creator of Eyes on the Prize, he was the most resolute man I've ever worked with. And he was not going to take no for an answer. We were just going to forge ahead and get this thing done one way or another.
And a large part of this book is his story.
Yes.
Which has a lot of complicated twists and turns. He had an unusual background. What did his father do?
Well, Henry Hampton was born in segregated St. Louis, Missouri, in 1940, Missouri being the northernmost slave state. His father was a surgeon and medical director of the Homer Phillips Hospital for Colored. They lived a very, very upper middle class life. Henry was born into about as much privilege as a young black man could expect in segregated St. Louis in those days. He kind of had it all as a young man coming up. He was a star athlete. He was well liked.
His father actually started treating white patients. Wasn't that unusual?
His father did treat white patients, which was very, very unusual at the time. And eventually he began doing house calls to white patients, which was even more unusual. His father wanted Henry to go to medical school, which Henry did, and he dropped out after a year. Thank God for us that he did not become a doctor. He became a great filmmaker instead.
Did he accompany his father on the house calls?
He did. As a child, both Henry and his young sisters, accompanied their father on the house calls.
But wasn't their house actually in the white section of St. Louis?
Yeah, I mean, St. Louis, like virtually all American cities at the time, had sometimes coded and not so coded sometimes racial restrictions on who could live where. And the Hamptons were one of the very, very few black families in St. Louis that lived just a few inches over the line into a white neighborhood.
Well, since Eyes on the Prize is all about the civil rights movement, how much racial prejudice had Henry actually experienced while he was growing up?
Well, Henry grew up inside sort of the stockade of upper middle class African American life in St. Louis.
Part of the 10%.
Yeah, part of the talented 10th, sure. And he witnessed an awful lot of discrimination. Obviously, the schools were segregated. Black and white communities had separate cemeteries. They had separate waiting rooms. They had separate histories. He saw young white waiters refused service to his father on a Sunday outing. He had to swim at the YMCA on colored night, had to play tennis at the municipal tennis courts on colored night.
But he didn't go to public school.
He did not go to public school. The whole family converted to Catholicism when Henry was about eight because his father saw that the best schools in St. Louis were the Catholic schools, the Jesuit schools. And
they were integrated?
They were integrated, yeah, way before the Supreme Court decision of 1954. He then went to Jesuit high school, and that's where he became Henry Hampton.
But when and how did he contract polio?
Well, in 1955, there were two traumatic events in Henry Hampton's life. And the first was the murder of Emmett Till in the hamlet of Money, Mississippi, by two white men who were acquitted by an all-white jury, despite the astonishingly courageous testimony of Emmett Till's uncle, Mose Wright. Henry, like thousands of other young black folks of his generation, saw the picture of Emmett Till's battered face in Jet magazine, and it forever rattled his notion of what it meant to be a young black man, where his life was not worth a whole lot in many parts of this country. So the same year as the murder of Emmett Till, 1955, Henry woke up one morning, could not move his legs. His father recognized immediately that he was paralyzed with polio. They rushed him to the hospital. And after about a month in the hospital, he emerged. He emerged as a paraplegic after a lot of physical therapy. About a year later, he was finally able to walk with a steel brace on his left leg, and he wore that brace for the rest of his life.
But it took him a couple of years, and it was 1968, a year that many people consider a watershed year in the history of the United States, for him to actually start his own documentary film company.
Yeah, you know, when he marched across the Pettus Bridge, he was not yet a filmmaker. And in 1968, which was, 1968 was a very tough year to be American. It was a terrible year to be American. Our leaders were killed. Dr. King was killed. Robert Kennedy was killed. I mean, within months of one another, there were riots that erupted in 100 cities around the country. This mysterious war in Vietnam was ramping up. And that was the year that Henry, he was sort of a loony optimist, you know, when the rest of us were just consumed with fear and loathing, and we didn't know if the center would hold. Henry said, this is a great year to form a documentary company. So he founded a little company called Blackside in Boston. And throughout its history, Blackside, there was a lot of folklore that Blackside was a black-only company. It never was. It always was a resolutely multicultural multiracial company. All of the executive decisions were made by Henry and mostly by other African Americans.
The first film that Henry Hampton did was Say Brother, or was it the Gunspot?
A very interesting, very powerful program in Boston called Say Brother. It was one of the first examples of black television. But Henry was a contributor to that. He was a host often on that. The first actual film that he made was a 30-second public service commercial in 1969 in Boston, and it was called The Gunspot. It's legendary. It's now gone. There's no copy of it exists. Hmm. But it involved a shot of a little blonde 7-year-old child. Just a shot of his face, and he's obviously doing something off camera with his hands. And as the camera pulls back, you see that this cute little fellow is actually field stripping and loading a 45 caliber automatic pistol. And that was all. And then there was a tagline in text that said, "Racism is like a loaded gun." And this was a time when, no one on television but... no civilians on television, but Black Panthers and private investigators had guns. And it really, really caught the attention of Boston.
His first attempt at a multi-series program was titled America, We Love You Madly. Who funded that?
Well, Henry's, Henry some people said he had lacked expertise in managing money. Others felt that he was heroic because we got a lot of films done.
But he didn't always pay the people.
Yeah, not always.
Who, even though they admired him.
Yeah. Well, the first attempt to tell the grand story of civil rights was actually for ABC Television. At that time, it was called Cap Cities Television. They were merging. And Henry proposed an enormous, epic 26-part series called America, We Loved You Madly, which is ranks among the most unwieldy titles ever of a television show. It was actually Duke Ellington's farewell to his audience at the end of every concert. And he set out to do it pretty much alone with half a dozen people. None of them really knew what they were doing. They barnstormed through the South. They went to Money, Mississippi, and tried to track down the murderers of Emmett Till. They got run out of town. They tried to interview Julian Bond, the late Julian Bond, in front of the little store in Money, Mississippi, where the events took place. They were run out of town again. They tried to, they went and they were filming the spot where the murderers threw Emmett Till's body in the river. A state trooper came up and ran them out of town again. And they ended up on that series with very, very little real footage. I mean, this was primetime television. And the whole thing was a train wreck. It crashed. It completely went down in flames.
Did it look like Blackside was going to go under?
Well, it did look like Blackside was going to go under. And in fact, the footage that remained went into a vault in Boston. And by 1980, Blackside was down to one employee, and that was Henry Hampton, alone in his office.
There were four strong themes that ran through each segment. What were they?
I hope I can remember all four. Well, the most important was that the civil rights movement, beginning way before the desegregation decision in 1954 and up through the present, really, was driven from below as much as from above. It was driven by local organizers who labored for years that no one ever heard of. Tens of thousands of citizens in Montgomery, Alabama, who walked to work for a year. And Henry really wanted to put them on camera. He didn't want to put on camera the historians who wrote about them. He wanted to put them on camera. So we found them and interviewed them. He also wanted to make it clear that the successes of the civil rights movement could only work in a functioning constitutional democracy, where there was an interplay between state control, local control, the federal government, the judiciary, and no matter how bad things got in Birmingham, Alabama, up against the dogs and the fire hoses, with enough verve and organizing, you could leapfrog over the bad actors in Alabama and you could get relief from the federal government. Henry, like thousands of other young black folks of his generation, saw the picture of Emmett Till's battered face in Jet magazine, and it forever rattled his notion of what it meant to be a young black man, where his life was not worth a whole lot in many parts of this country.
In 1955, an African-American teenager named Emmett Till came down from Chicago to visit relatives in the Mississippi Delta. During his trip, Emmett Till was kidnapped and brutally murdered by white men. Soon after the crime, the men responsible were acquitted by an all-white jury. News of the murders spread and eventually helped to spark the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Historian Tim Tyson spent years researching the story of Emmett Till. His work includes also the only interview with Carolyn Bryant. And back in 1955, Carolyn Bryant's testimony was at the center of Emmett Till's murder. But in her interview with Tim Tyson, she says that part of that testimony was untrue. Tim has put his research into a new book, and it's called The Blood of Emmett Till. And he will speak at several bookstores across North Carolina in coming weeks. But first, he joins us in the studio now. Tim Tyson, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
Good to have you.
As always.
Well, we think we know a lot about Emmett Till. You decided to write a book about him. Why?
I got a phone call from a nice woman in Raleigh who said she loved Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. My book about North Carolina and race in America, and the murder that happened in 1970 under remarkably similar circumstances to the murder of Emmett Till, really. But and I was getting off the phone. I politely thanking her, but getting off the phone. And she heard that and said, well, my mother-in-law, I gave her the book for Christmas, and she really liked it. And she's coming to town next week, and we'd really like to get together and have a cup of coffee with you. So I pretended she hadn't said that and just was politely and warmly getting off the phone. And she heard that and said, well, you might know about my mother-in-law. Her name was Carolyn Bryant. And, of course, I'm a historian of the Civil Rights Movement in the U.S. in the 20th century in the South, so I knew, like anybody of that description, that Carolyn Bryant hadn't said a mumbling word since 1955 about the lynching of Emmett Till and had never granted an interview, had been pursued by journalists and scholars for decades. And so I allowed us how I might have time for that in my schedule. And I thought just to interview her, because I'm a historian and that's my job, and I thought I would interview her and put the interview in the archive, and then some historian in the future would be very grateful to me. But that was just my job. So I went to the library to prepare for the interview, and I thought this was a familiar story, that there was lots of history written of it. It was in textbooks that we teach our children. It was in magazines and newspapers and ballads and poems and novels. And there's a stack full of stuff. But there was only one history book about the Emmett Till case, which was a flimsy little book and didn't have much research in it. And that was what there was. And so that sort of got me to thinking. I was working on a different book. But then when I talked to Carolyn, her interview opened up enough pieces of the story that we didn't have that I began to think about writing a book. And then over the next few days, looking through my notes, I felt moved to do so.
Remind us and tell us the story we do know of Emmett Till.
We do know the one that has been told is a story about a horrifying Southern horror movie starring the redneck Frankenstein, and it's basically just that. It's a horrifying story about race and murder, but that's the extent of it, really. And if you look at Eyes on the Prize, say, which is probably the most well-known narrative of Emmett Till's death, it's really almost a suicide by redneck, because they get to tell the story. After they were acquitted, then they were paid by Look magazine to tell their story, and they had to tell that they had killed Emmett Till or they wouldn't get the money. But everybody assumed that if you could admit to killing a 14-year-old boy, that everything else you say must be true, because why would you lie about that if you told the truth about this? So that was what the narrative rested upon. They told a story of a black boy so dumb that he told them, you know, yes, I've had sex with white women. I'm going to keep on doing it. You know, I'm as good as you, your grandmother, you know, who was mouthing off to them endlessly. You know, it's patently a lie. This is a boy who's kidnapped at 2 a.m. out of his great uncle and aunt's house by 2 drunken white men with guns. You know, there's no way. I always knew that was not true. But what they didn't tell, they told the story that covered up for their relatives and kinsmen and friends. There was not a murder by two men. So the story is actually quite different. But more importantly, what the story has left out is not so much the horrifying brutality that was endemic to Jim Crow social order, but what people did with it. You know, this crucifixion story has come without a resurrection story. Right. Nobody ever tells the story of how a courageous and politically astute mother, determined to take her private agonies and turn them into a political act, organizes Black Chicago, which has been over the decades has accrued, you know, the most all this black power, the most powerful black political machine in the country, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and other black unions, the Packing House Workers of America and other interracial unions that are becoming civil rights unions, a huge NAACP chapter led by labor union militants, the progressive black and some white churches. All of this strength in black Chicago becomes a megaphone, turns this into an international story.
To reiterate, Emmett Till came from Chicago. Yes. He was down. He had spent years, and so it's not like his first time, his first visit to the South. But that was part of the narrative, too, that he came down there from Chicago in a place where the law of Jim Crow wasn't quite as explicit, and you know the nuances may not have been known to him, and he sort of stumbles into this nest of white terrorism and doesn't know what hit him.
Yes. And in fact, he had stumbled into a political environment in Mississippi in which African Americans were pushing for voting rights and the integration of schools. Brown versus Board of Education earlier that spring. Black parents, organized by the NAACP, by the hundreds, took petitions to the schools for their children to be enrolled in previously white schools. There were majority black counties in Mississippi with not a single black registered voter. Black folks could not vote in Mississippi, and they were pushing to do so. And there were a number of assassinations of black voting rights activists. That's within a few weeks of when Emmett Till is murdered.
Part of the campaign.
He's almost collateral damage in this furor about race and citizenship.
And voter suppression.
Yes, absolutely.
Voter suppression, which is what happens when with this kind of white anxiety, and we thought it was over forever, and now we're seeing it again in North Carolina.
Right.
I want to get back to Emmett Till's mother, because he does go back to Chicago, and as you say, that's a place. So there was organizing going on in Mississippi, which heightened white tension, the potential loss of white privilege, unearned white privilege through the ballot box. We're going to suppress the black vote. That's happening in Mississippi. Emmett Till is brutally killed, and then his mother doesn't let this story die, because, of course, there had been other lynchings in the South, and they didn't get this kind of attention. Tell us about her efforts, the attention that it brought, and the effect that it had.
She insisted that the body be brought back to Chicago from Mississippi, the mangled, bloated, horrifying body of her son be brought back to Chicago for an open casket funeral. Before the body even got there, she began calling reporters. And so when the body arrives at the train station, she is there, but hundreds of other people are there and lots of reporters. Somewhere between 100,000 and 250,000, depending on which reports you believe, but people came and viewed the body at the funeral home. What unrolled from that is this global news story.
The photograph makes Jet Magazine.
Right, because
others,
of this. Yeah, Jet Magazine, but also the Soviet Union and the United States are grappling for control of the whole world, which is mostly dark-skinned. And America's big problem is its own racial domestic politics, where the Soviets are turning to the people of color all over the world and saying, you call this democracy? Mm-hmm. Showing them a picture of Emmett Till's battered body and other such atrocities. So this becomes an international crisis for American foreign policy. It becomes a political crisis across the country. It builds the infrastructure that turns, and at that point, what we think of as the civil rights movement is a series of, you know, local movements all over the South, local people struggling for equality, but it's not a news story. These are isolated movements. What happens with the Till story is it becomes a national news story, and it becomes a national movement. The movement to protest the lynching of Emmett Till and the acquittal of two of its killers, it turns into this national movement that funds the Montgomery bus boycott. Dr. T.R.M. Howard from Mississippi, who is one of the grassroots activists around the Till case, he is invited to speak by Martin Luther King at Dexter Memorial Baptist Church. There's a woman named Rosa Parks in the congregation. She's deeply moved. 4 days later, she's arrested on a bus in Montgomery because, as she said, I thought about Emmett Till and I could not move. You know.
Yeah, but you make the point, you've already made it implicitly, but let's make it explicit, that there was a civil rights movement underway. It was a long civil rights movement that began decades earlier and was and manifest in many, many ways.
Yes.
This was a spark that brought things together, but you and no one else would say this started the civil rights movement. I know you're not saying that, but I want to make that clear.
It depends on what you mean. People say civil rights movement. I always want to go, well, which one? We're talking about a black freedom struggle that really takes place over centuries, but in the 20th century, there are lots of surges, but in the post-war In post-war America, political conditions changed and made it more conducive. And all of these local movements, because of the Till case, came together and became what we think of as the Civil Rights Movement. Also, it's very important that the young people who coming out of North Carolina in 1960 organized the sit-in movement that spread across the South, that really turns this into a mass movement rooted in nonviolent direct action and driven by youth. That movement was people, they were all Emmett Till's age. They were 15 and 14 in 1955. Every single one of them that I've interviewed, you know, one and many others call themselves the Emmett Till generation. Yeah. They all know where they were when they saw that picture in Jet magazine. And Julian Bond and Charlie Cobb and Joyce Ladner and Bob Zell, all these people say that that experience, the brutality and the injustice of that, John Lewis writes about it in his autobiography, led them to join the Civil Rights Movement.
We have to get back to Carolyn Bryant now. Yes. That's how we began. Let's talk about her testimony and what changed and how she talked to you about that testimony. Yes.
I've been a little surprised that people have been so interested to know that she lied in court. You know,
and you're going to have to give anybody us that testimony. Tell us what she said, because it's relevant, because somehow in a case where she talks about the overtures that he made to him, yes, and the gestures, which weren't illegal, would have possibly justified the homicide. That's the first of all, it's yeah, it's even if she was telling the truth, you right, really can't brutally, you can't kill somebody because they did that. And yet this becomes kind of pivotal testimony in this case. Well, so tell
actually,
us what she said.
Not really. It isn't really pivotal. The judge actually will not let it be. Let her testify in front of the jury. Hmm. They removed the jury from the courtroom. Of course, the defense knows that the jury is going to hear about it. Right. They also, after she testifies in court, and what she testifies to is essentially that he'd come in, ask her for a date, grabbed her hand over the counter, asked her for a date, come around the counter, grabbed her around the waist with both hands, spoke filth to her, told her he had sex with white women before. She wouldn't even say what letter the word began with, and that she got away from him with great difficulty. She described a sexual assault would be mm-hmm, what it would be, you know, legally. So she left the store, went out the front door, got a pistol from underneath the seat of her sister-in-law's car, and then he whistled at her. You know, some of that's true, most of it's not. The story that she was telling, though, was a very familiar narrative. It was a narrative created at the turn of the 20th century to justify lynching, to justify any length of violence or repression against black people and their disfranchisement from voting, which was a story about the black beast rapist and the southern white, fairest flower of southern white womanhood. You know, it was an old narrative that was already in the heads of everybody. They didn't have to tell the jury this, but she testified to that story. But a few days after the incident, when her husband had been arrested, she was interviewed by the family attorney, and he took very careful and clear notes about what her story was. And what she described then was a boy that insulted her, a boy that was rude, a boy that was annoying or infuriating, really. And he violated her racial sensibilities, that's right, clear. But there's no mention of anything physical, sexual, or menacing in her account in private to her attorney. But then a couple of weeks later, she tells this story of the black beast rapist.
And I've got about a minute left. What did she tell you?
She said, well, that part's not true. She was referring to the physical
sexual
assault
yeah,
account. And she also, I think, you know, said, in her words, nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
Damn you, Obama.
Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin have written a book called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin, about their relationship with their son, his death, the court case, and his legacy. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good morning.
Did you feel that there was a story to be told that hadn't been told in all of the news coverage? Is that one of the reasons you wrote this book?
We basically felt that the news just did like headlines and like a quick summary. And so we wanted to give our account of what we experienced as parents of Trayvon Martin. We feel like we were the best persons to speak for him since he's not here. And so who better than his parents?
How old would he be today?
He'd be
22 on February 5th.
February 5th, yes.
And you've chosen to tell this story in alternating chapters, each of you writing a chapter?
Yes, because we felt like if it was a book all about me or all about Tracy, instead we decided to write alternating chapters so that the reader could see both parents' side of view.
I thought it was because you divorced some years ago. You were born in Miami, but raised in East St. Louis?
Correct.
What was life like there? The East St. Louis is a largely African-American town.
Correct. Life growing up, it was good. It was good. It was 99.9% African-American. And growing up was tough there. I grew up in a single-parent home. But my mom worked several jobs to provide for me and my brothers, and she taught us, she instilled some great values in us as young men. And
did she give you the talk?
Oh, she always gave us the talk.
About racism?
About racism, because we had surrounding cities around East St. Louis that were predominantly white. And, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, racism was still alive and showing. And so by being from East St. Louis, we used to be in certain areas, and we would get called out our names and even chased at times.
And you gave Trayvon that speech?
Correct. We just let him know, and not saying that Trayvon grew up in that same era, whereas he would get chased in his own neighborhood, but just knowing that what we had been through as young men, young African-American men, that it would be a possibility that that could happen.
He went to a couple of different high schools. Why did he transfer?
Well, I transferred him from one school to another school, even though he liked Miami Carroll City. I transferred him to Dr. Michael Kropp because I thought it was a better school. And they gave schools grades at that time, and Dr. Kropp got a better grade. And so I just felt like he needed a change. He was transitioning from kind of the little boy to the kind of a teenager, and I just thought that he needed a change, and I changed the schools.
And you say that problems started to arise at the start of his 11th grade school year.
Correct. That's
what was happening.
That was right when I changed the school. Mm-hmm. At the other school, he was there with a lot of his friends and everything. And so I know there was an adjustment where he had to make new friends. I know that. And because he would tell me he didn't know that many people there. And I'm like, you know, you can make friends. I mean, he was a friendly person. He was a people person. So I just felt like he could make new friends. And eventually he did, you know, some good friends, some bad friends, but, you know, nevertheless.
That's what high school is.
Right, right. He had to pick and choose and decide which ones were going to be, you know, beneficial for him. So I changed schools because I felt it was a better school.
Why rest in power?
I think that it speaks for itself that we know that Trayvon is resting in peace, but look at everything that's going on behind his name. Look at his legacy. Look at the movement that his name has sparked. And so it's a lot of power behind Trayvon's death, and it's a fight. It's a fight for justice, and so Rest in Power is definitely a name that we feel proud of.
Now, why do you think that the reaction to what happened here was more powerful than similar incidents in the past?
I think people were just a little sick and tired. I believe that since Emmett Till and maybe before some others, that people just continue to hear about African-American young men and women being shot and killed, and nobody does anything about it. And I think when this happened with Trayvon, I think that that was the last straw for a lot of people. And instead of just complaining about it, they wanted to do something about it. And so I think that's why so many people, you know, they just could not understand, just like we could not understand why you had a 17-year-old that was unarmed. You had a 28-year-old man with a loaded gun. How could that possibly be any comparison? And so I think that's the reason why so many people were involved. They were just sick and tired of the same thing continuing to happen. And that's why they came out to rallies and protests, and so many people got involved.
Tracy, why did Trayvon come to visit you on that week in February?
Well, he wasn't visiting me. I live in Miami.
He goes from one the two homes at different times.
No, he was living with Sabrina actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, he had the luxury of spending time with either of us anytime he wanted to. But at the time, he had been suspended for school, and so I was going to Orlando that weekend. And I wanted him to just, as you know, I didn't want him to sit at home. My friend was living in Orlando at the time, and so we decided to send Trayvon up to, you know, he was out of school. We didn't want him to just be sitting at home doing nothing.
And then he wasn't there. He could have just been out. When did you realize that this was going to be a serious problem? Did you think about filing a missing persons report?
Well, he had not just been. I mean, he was up there more than one day. He was up there for almost 3 or 4 days at the time that this incident happened, and so that Saturday night when we last spoke, I called and asked him, did he have enough money to get him some pizza. And he had enough money. And so when we returned to the home Saturday night, Trayvon wasn't there. Sunday night, Trayvon wasn't there. And so I made a few phone calls, and his phone kept going to voicemail. I called my nephew's phone. It was going to voicemail. So I thought they were in the movies, because that was a plan that they had early in the day. And so it got late, and I laid down. And when I woke up, I searched for him, and he still wasn't there. So that's when I started calling the emergency numbers, trying to find him.
And when the police told you what happened to your son, you say that you knew the killer wasn't black. Why?
I didn't reference that the killer wasn't black. I know who the killer was at that time.
They already told you that it was George Zimmerman.
No, they hadn't told me at that time. What was told to me was that it had been an incident which occurred, and the individual was a white Hispanic male, and they didn't know what the particulars of the incident.
Sabrina, what were you doing when you learned what had happened to your son?
I was at work. I was at work, and when Tracy initially called me and told me that something had happened, but he didn't know what it was, and so I left work. And I went downstairs, and I was in my car when he actually called back to tell me what the detective had said.
And then later on, you said that you found strength in the lyrics of a song that was made famous by the Mississippi Mass Choir, Your Grace and Mercy.
Yes.
So that was the lyrics of a gospel song come to you in moments of stress?
Well, I needed something. I was by myself, and I needed something, and that's all I could think of.
You and Tracy identified Trayvon at the police station, but why hadn't the police taken George Zimmerman into custody yet? Why wasn't he arrested, although he'd admitted to having killed Trayvon?
Well, I initially identified Trayvon through photos at the house, and later on we went to the police department just to, find out what happened. And so that whole day, we were told, after I identified him, they say that they were going to send the information over to the medical examiner's office in Volusia County. And so I just wanted to, it was strange to me, Volusia County, that the detective decided to drive the information over to Volusia County when he could have easily just faxed the information over. And so I thought that was kind of strange. And
did you ever find out why that was?
I really didn't find out where it was, and there really wasn't a reason for him to drive that information 45 minutes away when he could have easily just faxed it.
Tracy, you say that your lawyer, Benjamin Crump, had trouble getting the police to release the tapes of the 911 phone calls on February 26th. Why was that?
I think they were just trying. They didn't want the 911 tapes released because they didn't, you know, it wasn't collaborating with the story that they were giving us, that the police department was giving us. It just didn't add up. And so we had to actually file a lawsuit against the city of Sanford to get the tapes released.
Did you have the feeling they were protecting George Zimmerman?
Yes, definitely. We felt from the beginning that they were trying to protect the killer of our son. And it was stated at night that the detective had some type of contact with the state attorney as well as the killer of our son's father.
You mentioned that you didn't want the Trayvon's death to be a race issue. How did you want it to be perceived?
Well, we just wanted it to be perceived as an issue, an injustice issue, a wrong issue. And initially, we continued to say that this wasn't about race. It wasn't about black and white. It was about right and wrong. But as long, you know, the longer the story played out, the more it became evident that race was an issue.
Well, the way the police, the Sanford police, were relating to you, withholding information, for example, about George Zimmerman having a police record, wouldn't that suggest that there was a racial component in it?
Yeah, I thought it was. At first, they initially said that the individual had no record, that his record was squeaky clean, and then just to find out through a news source that he had multiple incidents and run-ins with the law. That was a part of deception that played a part, a huge part.
Now, who's Kevin Cunningham, and what role did he play in pushing for the arrest of George Zimmerman?
I think Kevin Cunningham was the young man that started change.org. He's the young man that started change.org, the online petition to get the individual responsible for our son's death arrested.
And then the two of you decided that you would use the media as a platform to tell Trayvon's story? Otherwise, might the story just have been swept under the rug?
Absolutely. When Tracy encountered so many problems with trying to get information for a minor from the police department, Sanford Police Department, and then had problems at the medical examiners. We just encountered so many problems in different angles. I decided that I would not go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to the Orlando area, period. I was just like, you know, let me grieve here. Let me just bring the body back and we'll have a service for him. But when I got a call from Tracy and one of our attorneys, Attorney Crump, said that they were not going to arrest the person that shot and killed. They have the gun. You have the person. You know practically what happened, the scene and everything. Why? And they had no answers. And so that particular night, I packed up my things and I was headed to Sanford. We had a meeting that evening when I got to Sanford, and they were like, listen, they're not going to arrest him. They're not going to arrest him. And we knew then that we could not you know, have this tragedy swept under the rug and that we needed to reach out to different media outlets. But let me just say, it wasn't the larger industries that really started the movement. It was the young folks.
Who started the protest riots.
Right. It was the colleges and universities that put things on social media to make the fire start, and that's how it started. And then the cable channels picked it up, and then the bigger channels picked it up. But it was the college students that actually started the movement.
And then there were some prominent figures that helped you get the 911 tapes released.
I think that was due to the pressure that Attorney Crump was applying to the city of Sanford. There really weren't any reason why they should have held the tapes. And the mayor made a conscious decision to release the tapes. And he went against the advice of his constituents.
And so, Rita, you wrote that your attorney said the Stand Your Gun, the ground law, would not be used as a defense. Were you surprised when that changed as the
Absolutely,
trial progressed?
Because we had heard that term from the time the situation happened, which was February 2012. We had heard that term, that's what the defense would be using, to stand your ground. And then that was in 2012, and then it wasn't until 2013 that we found out, in April of 2013, that we found out that they would not try to use that as a defense. And so
it didn't seem to really apply. A boy walking down the street, a man in a car with a gun, he comes out. You would think that Trayvon's case would have
absolutely.
He would have been seen as the victim, not as the threat.
Right. I mean, through normal eyes, that would have happened. Trayvon would have been the person that was standing their grounds and not George Zimmerman. But in other people's eyes, you know, people see what they want to see. They perceive what they want to perceive. But at the same time, Trayvon was simply walking back from the store with a drink and some candy. No weapon, not committing any crime.
When George Zimmerman was being cross-examined by Bernie de la Rionda, did you feel, Tracy, that the questions he asked helped your case?
No, I don't think that they asked the right questions. They never asked him what was his motive for even getting out of the vehicle if he felt threatened for his life. If I feel threatened for my life, I'm going to eliminate myself from the equation and not get out the vehicle to see what's going on. And I just had a problem with a person feel that their life was in danger when you get out with a loaded gun.
So when did you start to feel that the trial was turning against your son?
In all honesty, we tried to have faith in the judicial system. But from the beginning, we knew that our hands were tied. We knew that when I heard a statement from a potential juror that said that Trayvon would have never been in the situation that he was in had I been involved in his life, I knew that our hands were tied. I knew that these jurors had they already formulated their own opinion about who I was, about who Sabrina was, about who Trayvon was.
Wait. So if you'd been more involved in your son's life, he wouldn't have been walking down the street?
Correct.
With a can of soda? Was it soda?
That would a can of iced tea. But that's the perception that the jurors had.
Why didn't the prosecutors call you to the stand?
I have no idea. We asked several occasions, you know, to call character witnesses. Who best to be a character witness for a deceased minor than his parents?
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 4th, 2017, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. dial in, share your thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions on things that have taken place over the last 7 days. You just heard a little snippet of a few things that happened with the audio segments we just heard. Certainly there are other things as well. If you want to share your thoughts, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. That just gets us right to everything that you need to do, so we can see your hand on the switchboard, get you on the line quickly. This is listener supported counter racist radio. If you would like to support Context to White Supremacy, visit our blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported in us nearly 8 years. Hopefully, we have helped some folks get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, help people get a little bit less confused. Thanks, again, to all the folks who have supported us. And I hope the cows has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. That's it. A couple quick things before we get to the callers. Again, we should be here tomorrow. I think the big ball game, right, is tomorrow. So we should be broadcasting live simultaneous with the game. I think that's been a tradition that we've done for a number of years here at the Cows. We're going to rebroadcast Dr. Welsing, one of her earlier visits. This is directly connected with the Delectable Negro, but I had wanted to play this broadcast last month in January. I was going to play it on the King holiday because Dr. Welsing, this is from the King holiday in 2012. It would have been 5 years to the day if we had done the rebroadcast last month, but a lot of that subject matter was about Jeffrey Dahmer, Jerry Sandusky. January 2012 was just a few months after the whole Jerry Sandusky scandal broke. He was arrested, this now convicted child rapist up in Pennsylvania. But we'll have that tomorrow. That would be Sunday, February 5th. It'll be live with the Super Bowl. We'll be able to go back and revisit the wisdom of legendary general and child psychiatrist Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Tune in tomorrow. That said, couple quick things. Number one, we talk about material that you can share with children to learn about racism. Certainly Eyes at the Prize would have to qualify and be high on the list. I would encourage any, if you are black parents, non-white parents, definitely make time. You can sit down and make it a summer project, but maybe you watch a video a week or two videos a week or what have you, and give a report on it. Or somehow summarize the information, talk about it with your child. But I would definitely say that's highly constructive material. I think even Dr. Welsing, she recommended it specifically to show examples, illustrations of black self-respect, black people, black males, black females, black children carrying out their assignment. Replace white supremacy with justice. Seeing black people do that, that just, you know, it can have a huge impact on how you think of yourself as a black person and knowing the mighty things that black people have done on this planet for thousands of years, way up to this point. So definitely check out Eyes on the Prize. Should be able to get it in your public library. And I think a lot of that material is online at this point as well. Also, the segment I think you heard throughout Mr. Hammond, the, I guess, driving force behind Eyes on the Prize, him growing up in St. Louis. I think you also heard that from Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy, where the St. Louis region, their connections to that area, St. Louis, Missouri. This is 2017 is the 100-year anniversary of the 1917 white terrorism. They call it race riots, but it's white terrorism in St. Louis. Lots of black people brutalized, killed. They're having major commemorations in Missouri and St. Louis specifically to mark the centennial. I'm trying to see if we can get some guests on the program to give more detail about what took place. If you're in the St. Louis area, you should definitely go because I think they have like exhibits and tours and all kinds of things that are going on. That would be another example. I say that all the time. Take advantage. There are so many different ways that you can teach, learn about racism, white supremacy, just checking out your local city, state history. So if you are a resident in St. Louis or, you know, in the close surrounding areas, make a little trip. Go check it out. You can go online. They have different resources available. You can go and you can teach your child about racism, white supremacy, what it means to be classified as white, and you'll be getting state history. That might help them, you know, for a school exam or what have you, or just to be more informed about the environment in which you live. Take advantage. Last thing that I'll get in, that segment on Eyes on the Prize, I did one thing that I thought was important. I took one of Julian Bond's classes at the University of Virginia, Cowbell, and we had to watch Eyes on the Prize as a part of the course. It was on the Civil Rights Movement, the class. One thing that I do think is important that Mr. Bond emphasized, the late Julian Bond, that he emphasized in his class, they said one of the main points of Eyes on the Prize is that even though you might have local bad actors, and wow, what a metaphor, bad actors, you might have race soldiers on a local level, but you can leapfrog and get intervention, another big metaphor, you can leapfrog and get federal intervention where they can come in and, you know, help produce justice. One of the major themes that I think Mr. Bond would insert from that class is that typically when you leapfrog to get federal intervention from more powerful white people at the federal level, they would not do anything. In fact, I just wrote about the revisionist history that people throw around as though white people and even a lot of black people were happy and looking forward to the March on Washington in 1963. We've done whole programs about that. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you go back and you look at the archives, Minister Malcolm X talked about this brilliantly in his autobiography and in many other speeches. But even if you go back in the Washington Post, right, mainstream newspaper, you can see it was total white fear and, oh, the unruly niggers are going to come to Washington, D.C. and run amok. A part of that revisionist history is blotting out that now Congressman John Lewis, he spoke at the March on Washington. That was one of his major criticisms in his speech that they forced him to edit and tone down, as they say, because he was so critical, because he had been on the front lines. All those beatings that he took when local race soldiers, when they would mistreat black people, and then they would go appeal to the Department of Justice and federal officials, President Kennedy, whomever was in the White House, Johnson, and these people wouldn't do anything. These racists wouldn't do anything. I think they said a lot of times they would have federal agents there, and they would just stand around and watch the black people get mauled and beaten. So, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. 20 niggers spat on, one nigger killed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that would be about the sum of their activity. I think that's hugely important. And Professor Bond, I did well in his class. He would for sure want that interjected. I think you can hear and see him in the series as well. Last thing that I will get in. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around all of the antics from the past week with the President Trump issuing this ban on refugees, immigrants from certain predominantly Muslim nations, as they say. I'm still trying to grasp, to come to an understanding, forgive the metaphor, I'm trying to come to a better understanding about all of this. Just again, anytime that I see a lot of white people, and I feel I've seen a lot of individuals who are classified as white over the last 7 days, like weeping and rolling around in the street, literally, and coming out on television, like, you know, big time entertainers and what have you, coming out and said, oh, this is horrendous and not in my name, and President Trump calling them a racist and a white supremacist, which they've been doing for, you know, a long time. Just that alone makes me very suspicious. Yes, absolutely. It seems there are many non-white people being mistreated around this and detained. Absolutely. I don't dispute that at all. Just trying to, as I said, figure out a way to process just any time that white people make an effort to pull my attention to something and aggressively and demand that you focus on this, and just the way that the information has been presented, I'm very suspicious. So if folks have thoughts on that, that'd be great. How could you not? That's been the key topic all over the world for the past 7 days. Again, I will request, if we could not use metaphors for the broadcast, leapfrog. If we could not use metaphors, it's been my experience, racists frequently, they will employ metaphors to deliberately spread confusion so that we do not get an accurate understanding. A lot of times victims of racism, like myself, we have been conditioned by racists. And a lot of times I think just in trying to better understand, we're still learning. A lot of times we are still trying to collect our thoughts and come to a conclusion. So we will employ a metaphor, thinking that that will help us articulate our views, and it does not. For this broadcast, if we could just be explicit, direct, right to the point about what it is that we want to say. No metaphors, just for this broadcast specifically. Thank you kindly. I will prompt about that. You could keep your remarks to about 5 minutes. That would be great. That way everybody will get an opportunity to share. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. First few people that dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to talk about the Emmett Till case. I remember reading about it because I have a book. I mean, I think several books have been written about the case, but I have a book that was written about 10 or 15 years ago. And in the book, one of the cousins that was at the store with Emmett said that Emmett did not whistle at that white female. Said he had a really bad stutter that resulted as a result of polio when he was a small child, and his mother taught him to, in order to get words, certain words out, to whistle, and that would help him to get the words out, and that's what he did. And some of the other boys that were not family that were envious of Emmett because he had nice clothes and he had jewelry, he had a ring his dad gave him. They put out that he whistled at that female, and then she just took it and ran with it. She embellished it. I guess hopefully that's not a metaphor, but I remember reading about when they found his body, that was when the show I Love Lucy was really popular. I guess it was the most popular show on TV at that time, and it had to interrupt I Love Lucy and have a news broadcast about when they found Emmett Till's body, and they said that his mother got all kind of death threats from whites that were so angry because their I Love Lucy show was interrupted. And I just think that shows how severely deplorable and evil and wicked whites are. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
other folks we haven't heard from like to share, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. A few observations. Excuse me. That clip you played where the white people were talking about their rifle, very interesting. I believe that the rifle, in the context that they're using it, is the system of racism, white supremacy. And also, think of Dr. Weldon, you know, the white man's gun versus the black man's penis, anytime they reference guns. As far as what you were just saying, I think that, you know, the ban on the Muslims is just white people. I guess we could call it white showcasing. You know, I think it's always in deception. We're so against this, but I don't believe it. You know, but as a part of their deception, they're always going to have a few that they let go out there and make it seem like they're on the other side. But really, I don't think it's really anything more than show. As far as for Trump, I like to say that he hasn't disappointed at all. I believe that he's pretty much the definition of a dedicated white supremacist. It's showing. I expect an increase of in the attacks of Muslims, like what we saw in Canada. I think that's going to start happening more as more rhetoric comes out and white people feel like, you know, they have the right to do this more because he's saying it. And I also could see potential to have assaults on Mexicans as the war issue starts to come back into play. As for host corps, blaming it on a circus-like atmosphere, this is why they need to appeal. You know, I think that comparing host corps to Cosby has a circus-like atmosphere. Host corps doesn't have Gloria Allred speaking on behalf of the victims. When that happened, she wasn't on CNN every night talking up for these 13 women. There were no white feminist groups with all their numbers and power outside of the courthouse. I don't recall even a huge Black Lives Matter presence. I just remember the Oklahoma artist from Justice, people that you had as guests, came on, and they seemed to be the only people out there at the time as far as what they were reporting. So I just think that's just they're using this as an excuse. And hopefully anything's possible, but hopefully this appeal gets rejected. If time persists, I would like to speak on a small victory I had on workplace this week. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. As on the prize, I think it's a pretty good series from the aspect, in my opinion, because it has segments within each program that it fits. It can fit into like a classroom situation. If you wanted to inform people, no matter what age, your ex teacher Julian Bond has a voice where you can easily understand him through the whole process. And I would say if someone was going through like a classroom situation on racism, white supremacy, Eyes on the Prize would probably be a pretty good audio-visual aid in that light. It starts off with the Till incident, and I believe it ends. I know the rebellion that took place down here in 1980 in South Florida. What I mean by down here, metaphor, sorry. The 1980 rebellion, it ended somewhere around that time with the series itself. Other than that, attended a church service with the team. We were invited, and I just went to observe. Hadn't been to church in a long time, other than to going to people's funerals. The first thing I observed that there wasn't any teenage black males at all. And this was a quote unquote black church, which is a problem in itself to say black church, but that nevertheless to identify to the listeners on exactly where I was. It wasn't any teenage black males in the place. We were only able to bring maybe about two or three. A lot of the other guys, the seniors, are actually in college as I speak itself, early graduating, and they're off to college. But I suspect it's because there's no relating with young people that comes from that institution, almost at all, especially with black males. So that was an observation that I got from that. Last but not least, on a good scale, I became a part of a quote unquote, and I don't like the word, but I have to use it, mentoring program. Showed up and was handed a T-shirt and said, "Get to work," which I don't mind that part in being in the company and sharing with black males. So I did this particular day, which was a day they went on a field trip. They went to a black male's home who happened to be an attorney, criminal attorney. He basically at his home with some food, and also he spoke to the young people. I always admire when you can captivate the attention of young black people. And I wasn't really looking at the attorney. I was looking at the young males, black males, and they were really paying attention to what he had to say. He was talking about his job and how he would not like the idea, because he gets too much of it, of having to come to court and see a whole lot of black males, and he wouldn't want that to happen to any one of the ones that he was speaking to. And he gave some alternative choices that you should or can make to a very, very constructive outing this afternoon. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to everyone. I'm the host. I just wanted to comment on a couple of things and share my thoughts, kind of workplace, but having to deal with the compensatory calling. The first thing was the Trump. I have heard a lot about that too. A lot of white people crying and complaining about him here in this part of the world. Kansas City, it seems like every white person who claims to be a liberal is attempting to show that they are on the side of quote unquote on the side of non-white people, very refined racism. And I believe that he is only being called out because he's destroying some of their more refined techniques they've come to master. I wanted to comment also on a incident that happened to me. It's very interesting. I've noticed commercials, a lot of commercials. I believe a couple of weeks ago, there was a commercial that was being spoken about Jerry Rice. If I'm not mistaken, it was a Popeyes commercial. But today, this evening, I was called out by a client to do some electrical work, change out some fixtures in their home. And it was a white woman and a white man sitting down watching television while I'm working. and I could see them watching television. Now, a church's commercial comes on, and they're both fixated on the television, but the church's commercial, and the woman is, yeah, baby, you know, we're going to, you know, non-white female, the woman who I believe Popeyes, I'm sorry, not churches. And you could see their reaction to it. I mean, it was almost like a chuckle that the husband let out as he kind of watched this. And they were watching Cops. And I was working for over an hour and a half listening to their reactions to Cops. And I can't believe Cops is still on television, because the image it portrays of non-white, specifically Black people, is such that, you know, no wonder these Black people have to be treated like animals, because look at them, they're on television and we have to lock them up, and every single one is stealing a car and has drugs on them. And I'm doing all of this, working almost literally in front of them, standing on a ladder, which it's kind of a throwback to Delectable Negro, because you can feel when people are watching you, watching your body when you're standing in front of them. And I really don't know what that's all about. But I just thought that very interesting, the images that white people continue to display. I mean, no wonder we're going to treat these Black people like animals, because they're portraying non-white people like animals on these programs like Cops. Very disgusted. But I wanted to bring that out, something I've never noticed. The last thing I'll mention was that while I was at the white couple's home, someone knocked on the door, and the white wife ran to the door. It was a non-white Black male. So I was kind of excited, because whenever, you know, Black people are around, I try to say hello. But I didn't turn from what I was doing, but I kind of saw it from my peripheral. There was a Black male at the door. And I could hear someone younger come in behind him. This younger person, to me, kind of sounded like a female, but like a white female. So I thought that this non-white, this Black man, was with a white female. But when I could listen closer to the conversation, still fixated on what I was doing, didn't turn around, I noticed that it was their offspring that they were bringing over to the White House, to the white person's house. I paid closer attention, and I finally turned and saw that it was a young Black male. He was dropping off at this white family's house, because the white son and this young Black male were going to go roller skating together tonight. I was really hurt by that, because just the level of confusion and the danger that this was a prepubescent young Black male, you know, had a very high voice, high pitched voice. You know, maybe, of course, he's dealing with a lot of abuse by the white people that are surrounding him. But I was shocked that a non-white person would do that. But then again, I mean, I was doing that same thing 3 years ago, so I don't blame him. I blame the white people that will abuse. And I proceeded to hear the jokes and comments that were made. I was extremely upset. I mean, I was just like, let me just get my stuff and be done with this. Hear the jokes that they would make about this young man, because he was a little overweight. And again, the level of abuse that happens even on the daily level is just incredible. I thought that was, you know, I would share that, and I'll take my comments offline. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? Oh, go ahead.
Okay, I'll take that to mean that I can be heard. Thank you very much. I wanted to comment primarily on the beginning clip, this semi, about the Hail Hitler, Hail Trump, because I think that, well, there's a couple things. First, let me say that I am aware of the immigration ban, and when I realized that it was happening, I myself can feel my own victimization and my own experience with terror, because I'm actually reluctant and resistant to paying attention to the news. Like, I've actually kind of dropped off the minute it happened. Excuse me. I became less interested in following the news when I realized that it happened, because to me, it indicated that we've entered a new phase. And the phase, like, it's, for me, the way that I'm perceiving it, is only going to get worse. And so I was afraid, and so I stepped away from the news just to go ahead and say that. I did catch up a little bit more yesterday. I will say that what they're calling protesting, it, for me, it is disrespectful, and I think it's false. I think the reason I say that is because Dr. Welsing used to talk a lot about that we non-white people, specifically black people, should take a look at some of the images of black people in the 60s when we were, quote-unquote, protesting, and the way that we carried ourselves and the level of seriousness and dignity and pride, I guess what might be a sufficient word, that we carried when we were protesting. And what I see people doing now is not protesting at all in any way, shape, or form. And I think that the people who are so-called protesting now link themselves to when we were doing it in the 60s. And I don't, if they're good, they should come up with a new name for it. For instance, I saw a clip about there was a dance protest. So all these white people were getting together and so-called protesting, and they had on, it was like a gay pride is what it looked like to me. And so I find that utterly disrespectful and a waste of energy. And I think this is built upon, Malcolm X talked about it in his book, people just want to say that they were there. Like, that's pretty, they just want to say, I was there, I was in that protest, I did something, whatever. This has nothing to do with anything, and it is just flagrantly disrespectful. The problem with the Hitler, Hail Hitler, and all of that is because there's a lot of propaganda. The Nazis used, and I'm not in any way, shape, or form very knowledgeable, but I do want to be, and I am reading and researching, because I think they're going to follow a very similar pattern. And in one of the books, The Destruction of the European Jew, the author says, well, how could the Jews just let that happen? Like, didn't they see it coming? And the author states that the problem with the Jew, what the Jew had done in Europe, was amalgamated itself to the point that it thought it was European. And I think that may be true for us as non-white, specifically black people. We've become so entrenched in so-called America that we think that we are American, and we are not. And I think that we will make a great mistake in thinking that Trump and whoever his successors will be that will continue this plan are going to only attack Muslims or Mexicans or Hispanics or whomever. It will be us too. And okay, so then the thing is, that's with the young people. So with the Hail Hitler at school, I checked out about 30 minutes of The Man in the High Castle because I wanted to understand, like, what's going on with that. And there's a lot of propaganda, the Nazis used propaganda, to tie in with what the caller previously said, that, yes, I can totally understand that white people love to watch cops and world star hip-hop, to be honest. And Dr. Welsing would talk a lot about the images. See, before, they would have to create those images, pay people to do those things. But now we have made that image, and that image has been spread around the world. So when the question comes, well, what do we do with these people? The answer is remove them. The answer has always been remove them, annihilate them, and not just send them away. Let's just kill them so we don't have to worry about the problem anymore. And I think that is what we are on now. And the children have been inculcated and indoctrinated, and I think they're being made prepped to be made very ready to do so. And so with that, I'm complete. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, I was listening to the clip with Trayvon Martin's parents earlier, and the host was refining his racism. When he asked about Trayvon's high school being transferred, I mean, still after death, that, you know, black bodies seem to be a nuisance. It's still disrespected. And I've been paying attention to the news lately, and I'm starting to see more and more white supremacists use the word white supremacists. I mean, the system has just become just more refined, you know, as far as like the dude in Seattle who lifted Trump's ban on the refugees. Approximately 60,000 refugees are allowed to come in America now. And I think that the whole thing is just a hoax or a charade to prove that you can go around government or at least use the system to work at your advantage. But I don't think that's it just proved that racism is more refined now. Because even before President Obama, even when Bush was in office, after September 11th, we started to see the administration, the head of state, move with complete anonymity. It seemed like they work with impunity. So we're starting to see these white people come out and protest the system and try to get things done, but it's just a way to confuse more and more non-whites into believing that things can that we have actual allies under the system of racism and white supremacy, and it's just Trump is really doing a lot of things within the last 2 weeks since he's been in office to prove that racism is more refined. They put someone up there who's obviously blatantly racist to try to tear him down and to convince us that we have people on our side. Even Nancy Pelosi came out earlier this week and called, I think it was Bannon. I don't want to be incorrect, a white supremacist, And that's all I have to say. I'll be more line to the call. And Gus, man, your voice came back quick, man. I'm glad to hear you doing well. I'll be my line.
Appreciate that. I kept my mouth closed and stopped talking while we were off air. Other folks who we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to all the callers on the line. This is Kendra from Orlando, Florida. I just have a few thoughts to share. So you can see the inception of the law and order Trump presidency, as was promised on his campaign trail, with all these bills impeding free speech by citizens being put forth. You can see the direction the country's heading into, which to me is racist way of putting people or groups, in their places. Trump presidential slogan is, Make America Great Again. We can infer from the slogan what we may. Secondly, black females cannot be raped by white men in this system of racism, white supremacy. We will be marginalized. We will be belittled, which you heard in the report. When the white man spoke about one of the victims being high on the stand, we will not be believed, which was the whole point of the report. White men who are predators by nature are keenly aware of that and know that they can take their chances in court, and more times out of not, they will be believed or acquitted, hence At the Dark End of the Street by Daniel McGuire. Lastly, I just have to say black self-respect to Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton for, telling their own story about their son, Trayvon, and shaping his legacy the way they see fit. I personally live about 15 minutes away from Sanford, Florida. So it's really nice hearing from the parents and their perspective on how everything unfolded. During that time, I was 23 years old and in college. And so I didn't pay, sadly, it's really sad to say, but I didn't pay any attention as close as I lived to it, to the Trayvon Martin situation. Friends would talk about it, and I was just kind of in my own world. Racism, white supremacy was not on my mind at that point in time. and I didn't have a thought either way about it. I did know a little bit about the story, but I didn't follow it. And it's just really, really saddening to kind of say that, seeing how close I was to it all. So thank you, Gus. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
For sure. Good to hear from you as well. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, you should be with us. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. Happy to be here. This is Jersey Girl calling from Jersey. Some quick thoughts on the news information brief. It's funny, when it seems like white people always try to profit off of black people's skills throughout the century. I think if anybody's really interested, Mr. Renegade had, I forgot the guy was on, did a whole wonderful show. He interviewed him about the Emmett Till. I guess you can email Mr.
Keith Beauchamp.
Yes, I want to email you and get that program again, because I have to listen. It was very some good information. And I just want to say to the listeners, no one should buy that book. I mean, this woman is, I don't know how old, 80-something years old, and she has the nerve to tell this man that no one should ever be punished or nothing could ever justify what happened. You're coming around at 80-something years old and saying that? I mean, I'm not going to say what I really feel. But anyway, I would never support that book. If you can get it for a penny, then you buy it, but not right now. I think a lot of them times white people do that, feeling that, okay, I can make some money or make some bucks off of this book now. I mean, this young guy, she had the opportunity to purge herself of that. There is no love lost here, or I'm sure a lot of African-Americans, even and his still mother wouldn't feel any sympathy for this woman coming out now and trying to saying that she's sorry or whatever is in that book. But I would never buy that book. And the guy who was being interviewed, I don't know, he just struck me kind of strange. I don't know. I was feeling a little something about him. I think, like I said, again, he's in it for the profit. Listening, it was a great scene on Trayvon. I never really heard his father speak like that. You know, they just kind of in the news kind of had Al Sharpton out there, a little bit of Sabrina, but Al Sharpton was pretty much in the forefront. A lot of the news was really around him when he made statements about Trayvon. So that was really wonderful for me to actually hear. I forgot his name. I can't think of his name.
Tracy.
Sabrina's ex-husband. Tracy, hearing him, very, very astute man. I was very taken back, by him. I think he really handled that reporter extremely, extremely well. But again, like I said, I want to email you guys to get that Emmett Till, because I like to. When I heard it, I was taken back by it. It was so powerful. If anybody want to really hear the real truth, they really need to really listen to that. And whoever the guy was, he needs to put his own book out there. But I'm just, like I said, again, tired of people profiting off of a black. If it's a white person, they seem like they more magnified it. And let's say, for instance, Gus Renegade puts the book out. Oh, yeah, a black person writes about a black person. But when a white person writes about a black person, it's like, oh, my goodness. Oh. So it was just a bunch of hoopla in the case. But again, I'm happy to be here. I'm always tuning in. If I don't tune in live, I'm tuning in listening to your podcast, Mr. Renegade. Thank you so much.
For sure. Mr. Beauchamp, he did the documentary film, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. Came out in 2005. He was a guest on the program in 2015. He's done many documentaries dealing with racism, but we spent a good chunk of the program talking about his work on the Emmett Till case, specifically Keith Beauchamp. He's a black male documentary filmmaker. I was kind of curious because he's kind of a respected researcher, one of the foremost respected researchers on the Emmett Till case, and is still very young, alive, very well informed about the case. If Mr. Tyson reached out to Mr. Beauchamp, or even what Mr. Beauchamp has to say about this new book from Timothy Tyson, suspected racist, I'm posting Mr. Beauchamp's visit on the Facebook page now. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, you should be with us.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So, just about the Dakota pipeline, the North Dakota pipelines, I find that very significant because I remember my school once did a kind of a semi-protest towards that. We went to the Chase Bank and the Bank of America. There was a Bank of America, I think, had a Bank of America or something. Those were actually the supporters of the pipeline. And we just went there to protest, and we thought we had some progress towards that because someone told me a couple of days after that they were canceling the pipeline access. And then I heard a few weeks later after that protest, they were keeping it back in. And from what I've heard about that, they don't know that they are the river that they're putting the pipelines in, that's actually most of our water source. So if that goes down, then we're just going to not have water. We're not going to have fresh water to drink, apparently. So I don't know. I guess we just don't. They just don't think about the consequences that they're putting towards. But, I mean, I don't know. That's just me. But just speaking of protest, I actually noticed that the authorities are actually fighting back towards these things. They're actually starting to, like, hurt people and, like, shoot people, basically kill them in a way. But that's why I stopped participating in school protests or just protests in general, because that's basically just risking my life, especially as a black male, a high school black male. It's just basically risking my life, and I can't do that. I just don't want to do that. And like I said before, protests don't make sense to me. I mean, I just think they're a waste of time. Just based on the fact that we're being heard, it's just nothing's happening. And yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
A young scholar in the Bay Area, always good to hear from him. That sounds just very similar to the suggestions Dr. Welzin gave some years back about the dangers of being a black person and going out participating in these protests. Racists have shown for many years that they have no qualms with accidentally killing, maiming a Negro protester or 12. Very smart thoughts from our young caller in the Bay Area. Other folks that we have not heard from.
Heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to Gus and the rest of the callers and the listeners on the line. This is Rob in Milwaukee. And I would like to take some time to highlight the white female today. I'll start with a white female by the name of Daphne Park. Female who was supposedly involved in the kidnapping and or death of Patrice Lumumba. And I think it was through the Black Talk Radio Network that somebody posted an article on Facebook that I was reading. And she was being interviewed by someone. And she said to the interviewer, and I quote, "I've always looked like a cheerful fat missionary. It wouldn't do me any good to go around looking sinister, now would it?" End quote. And I thought that was very chilling. You know, actually chilled me to my bones. You know what I'm saying? And it really put me in the mind of Jeffrey Dahmer, especially being in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Jeffrey Dahmer is from. You know, and, you know, I see that dynamic playing out. And the next I would like to highlight the white female who lied on Emmett Till. I've always said when I first heard that story, he did not whistle at that white woman. I hadn't read anything, hadn't seen anything. I looked in his eyes, and I said she probably was whistling at him. You understand what I'm saying? And you have all of these white females in these teachers, in these high schools, these white female teachers in these schools sexually abusing young black males. I think Gus, you had the story on where, I think it was on the compensatory call-in, some university where it was a tutor and she was making the football players or basketball players have sex with her daughter. And, you know, the white female, I think, really gets overlooked, very methodical, and the next female, white female I would like to highlight is Gus, can you come back to me? I'm a little emotional right now. I'm going to mute my line. Thank you for listening.
For sure. Not a problem. We should have time to come back around for your additional commentary. Other folks that are with us that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, proceed. Let's get our caller in Ohio.
Okay. Thank you. Hello to just the host and to all the callers and the listeners. And, you know, to the gentleman that was just before us, you know, I definitely understand the emotion because we are really being hit with a lot lately. So just a few things that I want to say. In terms of the Emmett Till story, you know, I just always felt I'm kind of like the gentleman before me, that he just didn't do that. And now that this thing, you know, I guess the truth has come out, and just some of the things I was reading, I just think about it, this was a white woman who wanted some attention from her husband. Here was a new black person in town. Think about it, his cousins, you know, they live there, he's visiting. And there, you know, in the story, you know, she presents this story to get attention from her husband. And unfortunately, unfortunately, it just ends tragically. And so like now, you know, how, because I mean, it doesn't appear that the authorities in this area where she lives at are moving to do anything about it. So, you know, because I mean, she lied. So I'm just not shocked at that at all. It's just like, you know, just white women being white women, and just how dangerous that they are and can be and are to us. Let me see. Ms. Bryant, good to hear the piece on Trayvon Martin's parents, and that like both of them were telling their stories. I just thought that was really good. It's just really sad, you know. I think it was Tracy when he said, you know, you couldn't give no information, and this is, you know, part of the problem we deal with. They just don't tell us nothing, and because they, you know, it's almost like I don't have to tell you anything, and we're not, you know, and it's like. And so here they're trying to go through all the steps to find out information, and this is what they do, you know. But anyway, I just thought it was good. That was just a good interview. And my last comment would be about these protests. One thing I'm noticing is not many of us out there, and when I talk about us, I'm talking about black people, so I am very happy for that. You know, let these white people protest. Let them do what they do. It's almost really kind of like a game, joke for them. But, you know, unfortunately, we see how things can go. I think it was last weekend when this ban came up, you know, like within 8 hours, 8 to 12 hours after that executive order was signed, there were lawyers at the airport. Less than 24 hours, the ACLU had gotten something like $24 million in donations. So, we know when they come out there, because to me, it is like a game with them. You know, they come out there, but things will happen when they come out there as opposed to when we get out there. These protests, if you want to call them that, have been going on since last Saturday. they're still going on now. I mean, you know, today, earlier this evening, I was looking at TV. So you had a little group in wherever Trump's Florida. And so they were marching over there, you know, trying to get close to where his home was to do their protesting. And I was looking at MSNBC, lady that was out, the news lady that was out in the field, you know, she was just talking about, she said, I noticed it's mostly white women. And she said she noticed it was mostly white and mostly women who were out there. So I'm just like, great, let people stay away, let them do. But my thing is, because with white people, we're protesting, they can be very dangerous people. And they can do stuff that, you know, there's no aggression from the police. None of that, as opposed to when we're out there, you know, we get it all, you know, National Guard if they have to, you know, so there's no aggression, like the police is there, we had nothing to do their thing. And so they, in my opinion, they do crazy things that really can result in people getting hurt. And a lot of it is, in my opinion, like playing for the camera. And that takes me back to the day of the inauguration and when they were up there on K Street having their so-called protests and, you know, breaking windows, doing all the things that they were doing, and yet the police just standing by with all their riot gear, not doing anything. So when it comes to white people and protest, to me, it's like it's a game. They're gonna get out there, and it's a game. But unfortunately, too, in this game, they can get some results. And if we get out there seeking for stuff, it's foot dragging if there's ever anything. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you, and I'll mute myself.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, hello, Gus, and hello to everyone. I just had a few observations. I'm not sure if I actually came in late, so I'm not sure if maybe this was in the segment or not. I noticed that there was this new movie coming out called Get Out, and it stars the black Englishman from Black Mirror. His name is Daniel Kaluuya, and it's basically about him being in an interracial relationship, going to meet the white woman's parents, and hearing stories about the suburb that the white woman's parents live in, and hearing stories about young black men disappearing. And when I saw the preview, I thought it was definitely interesting because it kept showing Daniel's face, and then back to the title of the movie, and it did that like a couple of times. And this was actually, I was watching a news station, and they were talking about the Muslim band, and then they play this preview. So it definitely made me think about previous shows where Dr. Kevorkian, and then you had another show with two black men, and they were analyzing movies, and it just made me think about, well, you know, like another caller had said, it's not just for Muslims, you know, it's also any of these rules, any of these bans that Trump wants to enforce or try to enforce, what have you, they can apply to us too, because we're not really citizens. The other observation I had is actually about basically a workplace of a friend of mine, a non-white black male, and he had told me about how at his job they really praise veterans. He works in a warehouse. They process a lot of different items, some large items, small items. The small items could be like from hospital, stuff like that, so they're very expensive. He had to work a long time to even move up just one station above being an entry-level person. Well, this white veteran, he comes in, and of course, since he's a veteran and also white, the upper management, his supervisors, they're very trusting of him. So they give him keys to all these different buildings and let him come in after hours, and he can just basically come and go if he pleases in a very short time that he comes into that job. Well, fast forward a few months after he's there for a while and they've given him all this different responsibility, things start coming up missing, but no one's saying anything. Well, and these are like heavy things, like my friend didn't necessarily tell me, but they might have been something that cost maybe a couple $100. So I guess it wasn't something that, and they weren't really good at tracking the items. Fast forward to a few more months, now the guy is missing, and there are tens of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise that is gone. So they have my friend and all the other associates coming to a meeting. They're checking through all their phones. They're saying, you know, if you have any affiliation with this man, we could be we could try to prosecute you too. And they are trying to find this man. So I just thought that that was, I definitely thought that it was funny how, you know, you're giving all of this responsibility and you're very trusting of this person that you essentially don't know, or they essentially don't know. And then he ends up robbing you for tens of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise and things that are heavy enough where he's loading them up to it in his truck and he has to use like a dolly, and it's not something that you could just carry out necessarily. I guess that'll be all that I have to share today. Thank you for listening.
Appreciate that. I just wanted to say really quick, if people remember from some years back, Kim Williams, she was a guest on the program the same summer, 2013, as the trial for the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. But she was on the program. We talked about her book and her web series, 40 Hours and an Unwritten Rule, which is about workplace racism. But she had a segment in the book where she was basically suggesting, in kind of a what they call tongue-in-cheek manner, kind of joking around, that black people come on jobs and kind of steal everything. And I made a point of saying, you know, the experts at being able to come on a job and steal everything, not just, you know, a few paper clips or a stapler, but like everything. Like you come and you don't have windows, chairs, computers, company, everything is gone, is racist man, racist woman, racist child. They will Enron you in a minute. And we kind of discussed that back and forth on the program, but just the anecdote that the young lady just shared reminded me of that in detail. And there's lots of examples of that just repeatedly, just what it means to be white. Other folks that we haven't heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and the listeners. I missed all of the news clips this evening. Just had a busy evening, so I missed them, so I wasn't too happy about it, but I was listening to the commentary, and great commentary by everyone. I can't wait to hear the archive. In reference to Rob, peace to you too, and to Thomas in New York and everyone else, when he was talking about the white woman, made me think of one of the greatest examples of how white women get away with all kinds of just malfeasance and just straight criminal activity. Mary Kay Letourneau, the child rapist who ended up marrying the child that she raped. She did a little time in prison. She blonde hair, blue eyed, small framed white woman. I guess according to the white standard, she would be considered quote unquote attractive. I don't think any white women are attractive whatsoever. And she's just gotten away with raping and having a child by one of her students. I think she was raping him when he was like 13. They put her in jail. They gave her a restraining order. She broke the restraining order and kept seeing him. She got pregnant and continued to see him. And I guess the courts just gave up and said, well, this white woman's going to do what she wants. You know, white supremacy wins. Just rape him for life. And, you know, it's just the things that these women get away with is just plain legendary. And I guess, did you get the clip I sent you about the Emmett Till story? I didn't hear it. I know you played something. I don't know what it was you played, but did you get the clip that I sent you about that last week?
The white woman, I guess, admitting that she lied.
That she lied.
Right.
Yeah. It's just disgusting. It's just like the way that these women get away, these females get away with the ability to literally cause the death of other human beings. And there's just no repercussions whatsoever. She lived a full life. She had kids. She went on vacations. She did all the things that white supremacists do, which is enjoy their life at the expense of the lives of the people that they kill and terrorize. And then, you know, at the end of her life, she comes out of nowhere to tell everyone, well, hey, I lied. Just unbelievable. And when retribution and justice comes down on these creatures, it's going to really be something to witness. And I just pray that I'm alive to see it, because I would just revel in just seeing justice be meted out on these disagreeable beings. I did hear some people talking about the protests, and I do also like, in my observation, that there are a lot less black people in these audiences. I just think that the rhetorical ethics of white supremacy is just, the refinement is at a level that is unprecedented, and the vast majority of black people who are more confused and who think there's a such thing as good white people, all of these protests will just further confuse them unless they get a better understanding of the way the system works and what it means to be white. And it's just good to see, in my opinion, that there's less black people out there, which indicates that there must be some understanding to a level where they understand they should not be in the presence of these white savages and law enforcement at all. Let them get their heads cracked and stay out of it. The other thing is that also Donald Trump seems to be facilitating not just a civil war amongst whites in America, but a global civil war between different white factions, whether it's the Europeans, the EU people, Russia. And I just think the more that they're fighting amongst themselves, the less they're focusing on us. And if they're not focusing on us that much, we should be focusing even more intensely on replacing white supremacy with justice. So I'm a big up to Donald Trump. Just keep the white people, you know, fighting amongst themselves. I'm just enjoying that. And hopefully we can make something happen. And lastly, I was just an anecdote from Friday. Yesterday, I was coming home from work, and when I travel on the train, I always put my backpack in the seat next to me so that no white people sit there. Usually, if there's a black female walking past, I'll ask her if she would like to sit, or a non-white person, or a black male. So yesterday, there was a black male that came past, and he just walked past me at first, and then he came back, and he asked me if he could sit down. So I said, sure, and I moved my bag, and I let him sit down. So I'm reading the book How to Deal with White People by David Goldberg, and sometimes if there's a black person sitting next to me, I'll purposefully let them see the cover of the book, hoping to jog a conversation. So he looks at the title of the book, and he says, oh, I have to get that. That's the first thing he says. So I just start telling him, I said, you know, this is a really good book, I think. And I think that's a book we should read on the book club, simply because Dr. Welsing has always discussed or always talked about what is it white people talk about when there are no black people around. That is a book where I wish we could have gotten her take on it, because that white guy is telling. That book, he is telling quite a bit. And I think it can be an extreme eye-opener for black people to hear a white person in their own words talk about the psychopathological functioning of white supremacy, because he lays it out in a way that is just phenomenal. So as we're talking, I start telling them about the cows. I mentioned about the book study club, The Delectable Negro. He actually took a picture of the book on the book cover. He wrote down Delectable Negro. We exchanged information. I gave him all the information about the show, the archives. I gave him a link to that. We were just talking all the way till we got to his stop, because I go way further down the line than he does. And he had hit me up late last evening and just thanked me for the information. And we're going to be in touch with each other. But he said he can't wait to get into the show, and hopefully he'll participate down the road. But that is something that I try to do quite regularly, especially if there is a black person next to me and I'm reading a book that's interesting. I'll let them see the cover on purpose, just hoping that when they see it, it'll spark a conversation. And yesterday it actually did. And I'll continue to do that, because it seems to work. And it seems, in my opinion, just from personal experience, there's a lot more black people, especially with Trump sitting in office, that are interested in learning more about racism, white supremacy. And I don't know how it works for other people, but that's been working for me quite successfully. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate the plug. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers and the listeners. This is the female caller from New York. Oh, it's a lot going on. I myself, Gus, like you, I'm trying to get a better understanding of what's going on with what President Trump is doing with this, with these travel bans. And I think that Raj used a word that hits it on the head with me, and that is, that word was, he's facilitating. I, in my melanin, don't believe that he is in charge of anything. I believe that he has, I don't want to call them supporters, backers, you know, the people who paid for his presidency, that he's working for globally. In addition to that, I too did watch the Amazon special that the young lady mentioned earlier, The Man in the High Castle. I didn't watch one episode. I watched them all, simply because I can just always recall our esteemed teacher, goddess, queen mother, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, informing us that we were watching the Nazification of this country occur. And I deal with a lot of symbolism when I watch these shows, not so much with plots and intricacies, but the one thing that stuck out about me, about the show to me, was the fact that at the beginning of the show, they showed in the introductions showed the United States divided. They were divided in, it was divided in a Nazi Reich on the eastern part of the country, the Pacific Northwest and the western part of the country, the Japanese owned, and then there was a section of the country that was kind of like towards the east, towards the west coast, but it was kind of like a no man's zone, whereas if you weren't in the Japanese portion or the Nazi portion, you were in this no man's zone, and that's where all the black people were. That's where all the black people were. That's where all the Jews were hiding out, that didn't want to be caught as Jews, who had changed their names. There was even an albino in there. You know, the rejects, the people who were not fitting any program in either one of those Nazified territories. So it made me think of borders, and it made me think of what Donald Trump, his ban, you know, and as I'm watching this, it's all like coming to life. And I don't think that, I think that the supremacists are using two of their greatest strategies right now. One of them is deception, and the other one is distraction. I don't know if anybody has heard these small blurbs about federal troops moving into Detroit to take care of the crime problem, but and I don't know if there's anybody on this call from Detroit who can give us some like boots on the ground type of reports as to any turn up of federal troops in Detroit. But I don't think that black people are far down the list of whatever this major agenda is. I do know that there are a lot of black Muslims in a couple of these countries that are on these this ban. And my thing is that I do believe that at some point that these things have to be put into stone. They have to be set as precedents. There's always has to be a rule established on a large scale before it can trickle down to be something on a small scale. So what I'm saying is that while you cannot come into the country because of your faith or where you are, or you can't leave and all these bans and these sanctions are placed on you, that that is not impossible to be formulated locally into you can't leave your house between the hours of 9 and 6 p.m. to go get a loaf of bread. Like I said, I just think that this is this distraction. I think that maybe we should maybe look at this a little bit differently, and that it could trickle down to a very, very much more concentrated local level, and that it has to be put into some sort of order first in order to get to that stage. That's the one thing I wanted to talk about with regard to Gus, what you said about getting a greater understanding of it. And I could be totally wrong about that. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was something that
occurred that I happened to meet back during the holidays. That, you know, I went to this holiday party, and I know this is a little late, but I went to this holiday party, and I just moved to South Carolina. So I'm trying to get some notes of people in my area, and it was given by, you know, like the local, you know, association or what have you. And right. So I go in, and the first thing I notice is that the room is divided. There's like a white Santa Claus in the middle, and black people on one side of the room and white people on the other side of the room. My main reason for going was to try to find somebody who I can hire as a contractor to do little things around my little area that I can't do, which is a lot. So I just needed to get to know some people. So anyway, there was a black gentleman there who was kind of head of like the section or one of the sections of the neighborhood. And, you know, I spoke to him and his wife briefly, and they said, oh, well, you know, we're going to recommend you this guy. I'm going to give you his telephone number and whatever, whatever. So they gave this guy's telephone number, and I look at his address, and I'm like, okay, he lives on my block. But I know that there's only everybody on my block is black except for two people. There's only two people. There's a white woman that lives across from me that's got a big monkey flag on her lawn, and there's a white guy down the block. And, you know, and I looked at the address that he gave me, and it's the white guy. And I said to myself, well, you know what? And I said to myself, oh, okay. You know, we got to realize we're in this war sometime. And I thought about the caller who called in a couple of weeks ago, who was a contractor, and who talked about, and his wife got on him. I think he bought a dog or something, and his wife got on him because the dog he bought was from a white person, and he said, you know, his wife got on him about giving the money to a white person. And I said to myself, why would he recommend this white person? Because then I've got to remember, I'm in this war, you know? So, like, what do I do with this guy? Gus, remember when we read that book, we read 2000 Seasons, there was a part in the book where there was a gentleman, there was a man who was an African who was playing for the white team, and the blacks, the Africans who were, you know, who were united, didn't go after that guy, and they didn't kill him, and they didn't do anything to him. They kind of just left him alone. So, you know, while we're in this war, we have to realize sometimes when one of us makes such a deadly mistake like that as to try to get us to give our money to a white person, what do we do with them? We leave them alone. But I at least I know where he's coming from now, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that, but the main thing was about that, the whole thing with the travel ban. That I think that there's a much bigger picture here, and I think that there's something that they have that has to be written down and you know, justified as some sort of law before they make it something that's more localized. But I do believe that it is going to be localized, so I'm sure that maybe we may want to think about preparing for that. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thank you for listening.
Very interesting. Wow. Other folks that we have not heard from at all have commentary they want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele, and I'm calling from Orange County, California tonight. And, yeah, I wanted to report that everybody has been, or I've heard a number of callers remarking on white women tonight, and specifically with respect to white women and this Emmett Till case. Recently, I pointed out on one of my outlets on Facebook that white supremacy is, or rather that feminism, as we see practice in society today, I used a metaphor. I said feminism is white supremacy in a pantsuit. And, you know, this got a number of people commenting and talking. And I posted that in reference to this case that right now, one of the core tenets of feminism seems to be to believe anything that a suspected racist woman says in relation to a black male and sexuality or sexual impropriety. And this has been exemplified in the so-called Hollaback street harassment movement. You can see it playing out in the Bill Cosby case. And, you know, I made these observations and these parallels. And a very old white supremacist suspect commented that, you know, that the accuser of Emmett Till was not a feminist icon, and that, you know, there's no racism in feminism, and that, you know, I have a misunderstanding, you know, the whole, you know, the whole litany of comments that are associated with feminists being confronted with the existence of racism in their ideology. And I just wanted to say that, you know, a number of very suspicious moves were made in that comment, including saying Emmett Till's name incorrectly, denying that racism had anything to do with it, claiming that we all knew that this lady was lying, instead of that it had been widely reported that Emmett Till prompted this whole interaction. So there's just a number of things that were made very apparent in this response. And I think that this situation was very revealing. And then again, speaking of white women on Facebook, one of these white women that is always concerned about the latest social justice issue of the day was recently making jokes, I guess that could be interpreted as racist. The post was something to the effect of Donald Trump will be offering student loan forgiveness in exchange for services rendered building the wall. And then I guess the joke was goes to work building the wall and protests it on her lunch break. So her and her racist suspect friends were all laughing at this article and at this joke, and talking about strategies how they could go about not feeling guilty as they participate in acts of racism. And of course, all of this was just a joke. Another thing that I have noticed with suspected white supremacists lately is that they are promoting this person, Milo Yiannopoulos. I don't know how to pronounce his name correctly, but one thing that I've noticed is that they seem to promote any sort of violence that's associated with any sort of reaction to this protest, so, or to this person's presence. And they seem to promote that any sort of violence that's had at these things are good things. So I'm suspecting that he's purposely drumming up a lot of this energy, and the people participating in the so-called protests of these demonstrations are probably agent provocateurs acting on his behalf. And that's basically what I've observed with a lot of these protests, is that I think that this is just typical white behavior in reaction to things that they desire. I think these are the only people that will protest and riot in reaction to winning championships, winning elections as well. So that's what I think is going on. I think that this is just all a lot of violent celebration, and it's sanctioned by the amount of discourse or the lowering of the decorum that is being initiated by Donald Trump. And that's my observations for now. Thank you for listening, and thank you for having me on. And thanks for this program, Gus.
For sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, this is a caller from Florida. I just wanted to really quickly, I don't want to go into a debate with anybody because I'm really not in the mood tonight. But I just wanted to say, as far as this travel ban thing, whatever it is, we as Black people should not concern ourselves with it to the degree of whether if it's somebody in a public space, a celebrity, from what I've seen, has spoken out on it, somehow have mustered the courage to take a stand. I mean, although I don't see your average Black person out there protesting this, which is great. Unfortunately, Black masses of people tend to be weak-minded and follow the leader, especially when it comes to a lot of our celebrities and prominent people. And I just feel that when those people that are in places of power speak out, it just creates a domino effect. So within the last week, I have commented or said my two cents and pretty much moved off of it. But I just wanted to make that clear to anybody who follows my page. When it comes to dealing with any other non-white people, I'll reiterate what I've probably stated several years back since I've been calling on the show, that by default, just from where I live at here in Orlando, Florida, or Leesburg, and I'm 10 minutes away from the Villages, I'm around multitudes of people internationally. I just came from the International Outlet Mall, and you see nothing but people from everywhere. And I look at it from a situation where it's either me or them now. I'm not worried about any other group at this time because I think Black people have done an extremely well job in speaking on the behalf of other people and being the best humanitarians hands down in the known universe. With that being said, all I'm saying is it is just simply time for Black people to worry about themselves. Use this time while Trump is doing whatever he's doing to these individuals who I would view as being white based off of how they live, work, and play and classify themselves. Use this time to strategize and get whatever you need to get in order. So that way, when those spotlights are turned off of those individuals and put on us, perhaps we may have some type of way to counter his actions towards us. Because at the end of the day, we're the primary target. And I'll mute my line. Have a good evening.
Evening, Princess. Any other folks that are with us who have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? You should speak now. Anyone that we have not heard from at all?
Hello, can you hear me?
Heard both of you. Our caller at 0093.
Yes, good evening, everybody. Called in a couple of days ago, but before I start, I'm 302 from Delaware. Called in a couple of days ago and touched upon the Muslim ban. And just to piggyback off of what the young lady just said, yes, I do believe that Black people should concentrate on their plight. Honestly, I feel that we've been here longer. We've gone through more. We've contributed more for a very long time. And it's time for us to look within ourselves and to pretty much band together, because I believe what she said, after this, it's us. It started off with the Hispanics, now it's gone to the Muslims, and after they finish focusing their attention on them, it's going to come back to us. So that's the first thing I wanted to cover. Second thing I wanted to cover was, I know we've been speaking about white women tonight. I haven't heard everything because I just joined about 20 minutes ago. But Gus mentioned something on the Thursday call about people being emboldened. And ever since Donald Trump has been elected to office, I've personally noticed this emboldenment, especially from white women, just in my day-to-day dealings with them. A few days ago, I went to a farmer's market. I went to order a smoothie. I get them every now and then. And this white woman was so rude. And she was so rude, the only thing I could do was be rude back. You know, something clicked in my mind to say, okay, you know, if I'm going to spend my money here and you think you're going to be rude, you're going to get the same treatment. And actually, you know, after that exchange, I felt guilty because I ended up giving this establishment my money. But after that exchange, I said, no way. Best way to combat nastiness, rudeness, and you know it's because of your color and who you are, don't give them your money and never go back there again. Today I brought my daughters out, and this is another situation. I brought my daughters out to a game room, you know, where you can bowl and, you know, you can do just about everything. And I'm walking with my two daughters, 9 and 7, and I'm walking into the bowling area, and this white woman is walking full speed ahead. And she basically just walks through me and my two children. So I say, well, excuse me. And then she waits until she gets about 5 or 6 steps away and says, well, excuse me. I mean, you see a grown man with his two children walking into the bowling alley. You know, say excuse me, go around the other way. But just don't walk right through. And the thing about it is that, you know, you don't see black people doing that. You don't see Hispanic folks doing that. You know, there's a level of respect when you move, when you go into an area, and you know, you just have manners and a little bit of home training. And ever since President Trump has gotten into office, I've clearly noticed this type of emboldenment, this type of disrespect and action. And the only two things that I can suggest is don't give the establishment your money. Well, first complain, which I did, and me and my two children will not be going back to that establishment just because of that one action from that one white person. And then secondly, you know, don't take the nastiness. I'm not saying be rude or get violent or anything like that, but, you know, they come at you sharp and you know you didn't do anything to them and you have that suspicion that they're being sharp with you because of your race, you know, be sharp back. And if it's someone that works at that establishment, go right to customer service, go right to management and say, okay, hey, what's wrong with your employee here? I remember Gus talking about how we should commend black people that serve us well. Commend them, write a little note, say, okay, hey, you know, this person was great, this, that, and the other. Anything to help our people out. But when you run into a situation where you were treated rudely by a white person, do the exact opposite. Write it all down. This person was rude, was nasty. They need customer service training. And you make sure that you call a 1-800 customer service number or you go directly to their manager and say, okay, what's the issue here? I think, you know, your employee has a problem. You know, I just wanted to share those experiences, and I'll leave my line.
Right on. The caller who dialed in simultaneously down in Florida, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gustos, the listeners and callers. There was a report that I had read about. It was a school up in, I think somewhere up in New Jersey, where I think they were having a basketball game, and some of the students in the stands, I'm assuming it was from a majority white high school, they started chanting ashy knees at some of the basketball players, I guess from the opposing team, primarily predominantly non-white team. And what they were saying on the report was that, you know, they didn't want that reputation on the school that was making these chants. So they had a white student come on there and say, oh, well, you know, it was just six students. It was just six or seven people. And I don't think it's, you know, they used the word F-A-I-R, you know. They used the curse word. You know, we don't want that reputation on our school. So they're trying to quickly silence the response. And they use the metaphor of take the high road, you know, or take the low road, or however it goes. And to make mention about the, I think it's the travel ban, I think that's some very strategic white supremacy at work, because it seems like, you know, they have to have all of these different labels, like how they have non-white people worldwide labeled with many different words, like African or Muslim or Hispanic, things like that. And they also have, you know, what they call stereotypes and different situations and code words like illegal and refugee, thug, you know, terms like that. And I think what they do with primarily their news resource is they do some kind of a pattern where they get people in general. Primarily, I think they want non-white people to focus on the different topics that have those core terms. Like, they want to talk about, you know, build a wall, they'll use that slogan. And illegals, I think their objective is to get non-whites to focus on that group, saying, you know, build a wall, you know, they still have my jobs, or, you know, I want to be patriotic. And then for the people, you know, who they are, they're calling illegals, they can say, well, I'm not a, you know, quote unquote terrorist, and just to keep spreading confusion, when primarily the people who are usually behind it, they'll be out there leading a lot of people with signs and just standing amongst a whole bunch of people in the street somewhere, just to constantly lead and navigate where they want non-white people's frustration and high energetic responses, instead of just going and calling every white person a white supremacist or something. You got to have the refined races, you know, get out there and say, you know, do a lot of hugging, be very emotional with the victims. While you have people like the I know a caller mentioned that Milo guy, or Yalo, whatever his name is, and you have him, a more blatant racist, create all of these violent reactions from people, you know, breaking things. And I think those have been proven, at least by the footage, would be a lot of white people. And they're ironically wearing a lot of black clothing. I think it's propaganda in that too. But just to focus on that, I think that's just a lot of confusion for us non-white people to focus on each other by using those different code words and different sectioned off topics. And they keep it going in a cycle. So they'll use one thing. When talking about black people, they'll use terms like Chicago, and then they'll talk about Muslim, then they'll say illegals, and then the pipeline, and, you know, they'll just keep it going in a cycle. And I don't want to keep saying that almost like it's going in a metaphor, but that's the way that I've interpreted. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Appreciate that observation as well. We are almost at the end of the program. We had one listener, they did want to share. They said, please let the caller know, I think Roz brought it up, the book How to Deal with White People was not written by a white person. David Goldberg, the listed author, is a pen name. The book was written by a non-white black male who was a guest two times on the program. Anybody that we missed completely, need to get a comment in before we wrap things up. Anybody that we have not heard from at all?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to speak about just a few things quickly. The focus on the ICE albino female is very important because, in my estimation, the ICE albino female is the most important piece of the puzzle to focus on, and a piece of the puzzle is a metaphor. So let me say, the people who call themselves white, their female is the one who reproduces the entire race. So they're the ones that we should be focused on. And what I will say to the ICE albino female is stop reproducing. Stop reproducing altogether. That will solve this problem. The other thing I wanted to say was that the way you get to an action is there's thought, then there's speech, and then there's action. You go through those steps. So one thing that I think I say and so that I can do is that I will end the system of racism, white supremacy immediately. I think Black people should say that out loud. Now that, you know, you've heard it said that it should be, you should actually say it. Now you have the thought has already been out there. It's been said many times, but I say you should actually say it out loud. Psychologists say that after the speech, then you do the action. So I'll just say that. And also, I wanted to ask, I know it's late in the program, so maybe next program or something. I wanted to ask if you had any suggestions, or even if you can do it now. You know, I just wanted to ask if you had any suggestions for an all-Black meeting, all-Black persons meeting in whatever city that we might reside in. How would we go about doing that? Is there anything that we should be cautious of? So I'd imagine there's many things we should be cautious of, but what would the suggestions be from the counter-racist family that has formed? And also the travel ban is particularly, it's concerning because now I can't travel back to Africa, or I am going to go back to Africa, but what if I go over there and I can't come back and come to my family, you know, because he extends the travel ban to this other Black country. You know, that's important. So if we get stuck here in America and we haven't developed our alliances with the other Black countries, then we're going to be in a very bad position. So we should get out there and do that immediately, form our allies with the different Black countries that exist. And then the last thing that I wanted to say was I seen on Facebook a meme, they call it memes. There was a meme that said, Frederick Douglass died in Bowling Green massacre that hasn't happened in history. And I just want to counter that because I know that racists don't make mistakes often. And when they say things, it's not a misspoken word or something like that. They're usually meaning what they say. And it's often coded, so you have to be able to decode it. I don't know what exactly it means, but it just stuck out to me, and I'm countering that. And that's the last thing I would say. Thank you.
Right on. We have second or two left. Folks need to get anything in before they wrap up. I would just say quickly in terms of suggestions, if it's going to be Black people meeting, I would be clear and kind of keep in the forefront of my mind what the purpose of the meeting is, because it's been my experience, racists, they do phenomenal work getting victims of racism, white supremacy, where we will have a specific task in mind, counter-racist task, that'll be our objective, and they end up diverting us where our time, energy, focus is on something totally different. Racists are very good directly, indirectly at that. That's one. The other thing, it's been my experience, my conclusion, really, if you are a victim of racism, you say you're less confused about this problem. One of your primary tasks, if other non-white people are the victims of racism are going to have contact, is to make sure you minimize confusion. That doesn't mean that you have to agree with what every other victim of racism says, or you have to pretend that you agree with what they say, or that you even, quote unquote, find this person pleasing to be around. But that is a big part of how this system continues to function. Non-white people being in conflict with other non-white people. I think for victims of racism who understand that, that has to be one of your major responsibilities. To the best of your ability, I'm going to make sure that we're not in conflict and that we get to stay focused on the whole purpose behind us meeting, having contact in the first place. Those would be two quick suggestions. Did anybody that we missed completely, final word, you have about 60 seconds. Anybody that we haven't heard from at all that has a hand up? If we got everybody, that is wonderful. Did we get everybody? Didn't miss anybody? No one has a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Wonderful. Rob in Wisconsin, you said you needed a moment to kind of regather. Did you want to give us your finish up your commentary before we conclude?
Yep. Gloria Steinem, quote unquote, the mother of feminism, very instrumental and causing a lot of havoc, wrecking the black family, Gloria Steinem. And what I'll end with is an interviewer asked Daphne Park if she had ever experienced sexism. Her response was, "An African chief, as a special gift, gave me a hoe instead of a spear." Thank you.
Hmm. Interesting. Wow. The tackiness abounds. Speaking of tacky, I did want to make sure I commented. I think people had said before some of the different interviews that were done. I think it was one of our black female callers when some of the Charleston 9 victims from the Mother Emanuel AME Church, where they were slaughtered by a convicted mass killer and race soldier, Dylan Storm Roof, where they just, I saw today they had an article in the New York Times talking about Mr. Roof saying that he has mental problems that was kept out of the trial. So I'm sure that'll be another appeal in the same, similar to what's happening with Daniel Holtzclaw in Oklahoma. But they were talking about Dylan Roof and whatever mental issues that he had. And I think we played an interview where some of the victims of his victims, they were doing a radio interview with a white male, and one of our callers dialed in and said, "Man, you know, it really it bothers me, and I almost see it as incorrect when victims of racism, we have to go and do interviews and tell what happened to us to these white people, that we should just be restricting and talking to other black people, black journalists, to get information about what's happened to us out." And it really came through in those interviews, all three of them, with Trayvon Martin's parents when they were talking with the white male, Timothy Tyson, who did the book on Emmett Till, and even when they were talking about Mr. Hammond, the black male who was kind of his vision to do the Eyes on the Prize documentary. In all three of those interviews, it came through, because I think it was a white person in all three interviews, different white men doing the interviews, but it came through in a glaring manner. Just the tackiness, even the question that they asked at Trayvon Martin's parents when he said, "I think the chapters alternate, so one chapter is right, Sabrina Fulton, the mom, and then it goes to Tracy Martin, who's the father." And he said, he was asking, "Why'd you do that?" And he said, "Oh, I thought it was because you all were divorced." Like, same thing. Like, just got to get some sort of tacky comment in. "I don't want to think of you all as working together constructively for your murdered son. I just want to think of you all as squabbling and bickering, black males and black females. You can't even get along to write a book together." That's the way that we want to project and think of black people. The tackiness all the way through, that came through. I didn't want to let the program wrap without getting that in. We should be here tomorrow. That would be Sunday. We will be live with the ball game. I think the ball game is 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here rebroadcast because we had Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing with us numerous times over the years live with the big game. And I had wanted to play the archive where she was talking about the significance of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jerry Sandusky, these white sexual terrorists and predators talking about the significance of them hunting black people, and this being an integral aspect of white culture, to rebroadcast, particularly now that we're reading Delectable Negro. I thought that would be a great revisit. That'll be tomorrow. Looking forward, live with the game. If folks haven't heard it, great. If you have heard it, be great to revisit. We'll move forward with that. We'll also, one of the programs that got rescheduled from last week when I was having voice issues, our guest who hosts the blog site that talks about racism, white supremacy in Brazil, should be with us on Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Just stay tuned. If you have questions, problems, guest suggestions, or you can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks again to everyone for tuning in to the program. I hope it's been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. We'll catch everyone in a little less than 24 hours. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Whites, alcohol, one of the worst combinations in the known universe. I know there'll probably be a lot of Super Bowl parties if you're in one of the areas where they're doing all that stuff this evening, Saturday, and over a lot of times that stuff will just carry over right on into Monday. I would just state again, sobriety would be best if you're going to go to any of those events and you got racists, suspected racists present. I would be very alert to make sure things don't get out of hand, even with other victims, because that alcohol, it can really lend, things can get awry quickly, and I mean in a matter of seconds. Particularly, you do not want to be out and about in a vehicle, having to do any driving around, same thing. You never know when you will bump into a Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no. You being intoxicated, where you've had a few to drink, or some cigarettes, or narcotics, whatever it is, that is not going to help you neutralize that situation and walk away safely, life intact, not arrested, not tased, not choked, or anything else. You want to come through that situation unharmed. And I think being sober, that would be best. I think there's a lot of evidence that being under the influence in those situations does not benefit black people, victims of white supremacy. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.